Call the House Judiciary Committee to order Monday, December 10th. We're opening on a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee bills and the concepts. Mr. Taylor?
Members of the committee, you have before you a list of bills, and what I'm going to do is read off the LCs with the dates of the LCs, and then one of your members on your side would have to move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 27 dated August 20, 2012. LC 158 dated November 20, 2012. LC 191 dated October 4, 2012. LC 209 dated October 23, 2012. LC 234 dated August 8th, LC 235 dated August 15th, LC 297 dated June 1, August 298 dated August 30th, LC 299 dated June 15th, LC 300 dated June 26th, LC 306 dated July 31, LC 307 dated December 6th, LC 417 dated November 1, LC 418 dated October 23rd, LC 422 dated August 31, LC 424 dated July 9th, LC 437 dated November 1, LC 450 dated October 11th, LC 451 dated August 9th, LC 452 dated August 21, LC 454 dated September 20th, LC 455 dated September 20th, LC 456 dated July 26th, LC 459 dated July 5th, LC 460 dated July 3rd, LC 466 dated October 1, LC 735 dated July 19th, LC 736 dated August 17th, LC 737 dated August 17th. LC 378 dated July 19th, LC 739 dated July 18th, LC 740 dated July 30th, LC 741 dated July 27th, LC 742 dated July 30th, LC 437 dated July 6th, LC 744 dated July 6th, LC 793 dated July 13th, LC 794 dated July 11th, LC 795 dated August 16th, LC 824 dated August 17th, LC 837 dated October 8th, LC 838 dated October 22, LC 848 dated August 28th, LC 857 dated November 20th, LC 929 dated December 5th, LC 1001 dated October 10th, LC 1122 dated October 5th, LC 1123 dated October 5th, LC 1207 dated October 16th, LC 1294 dated September 24th, LC 1321 dated November 8th, LC 1452 dated October 31, LC 1840 dated October 29th, LC 1873 dated November 5th, LC 1877 dated October 27th, LC 1936 dated October 25th, LC 1973 dated October 23rd, LC 2041 dated December 5th, LC 2580 dated December 4th, LC 2623 dated November 5th, LC 2764 dated December 6th, LC 2858 dated December 5th. Mr. Chair, hold on. I need to read one more into the record.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tomei?
Do you think we will get an explanation about what these bills are that we're going to be voting on today?
We're not voting on the bills. We're only voting to introduce them. You can not support or not support later on. It's the way we've always done it. If we were trying to explain 63 bills, we'd be here probably till noon.
I'm just a little uncomfortable voting on something.
Tomorrow, noon tomorrow.
We've always done it this way, and there's no obligation to support the concept when it comes, even, and it would be up to the chair to even give it a hearing.
Okay. And how did they originate?
Some are from individual members. Some have been asked to be moved through as committee bills.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could read one more, LC 854, dated 11/27, and all of those are 2012, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And these bills come from work groups. They come from people who traditionally file bills through the committee, for example, the Oregon State Bar. The vast majority of them come from the committee itself. Significant number of these bills, so we say placeholders, a very broad relating clause.
And as we said, you're not obligated in any way to support the concept, only to get these bills into the process to expedite the committee work when we finally get back in here. Representative Hicks.
Mr. Chair, I move the aforestated bills following administrative clarification. What was stated as LC 738, or LC, what, 378, is actually LC 738, dated July 19, 2012. LC 794, dated July 13, 2012, not the 11th. LC 824, dated July 7, 2012, not the 17th. LC 2623, dated November 5th, 2012. So, I move those legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Hicks has moved that the previously listed bills concepts be introduced as committee bills. Is there any other discussion? Any objections?
I assume it's all the bills that I read off that you're introducing, plus what Representative.
Unless you want to do it again. Okay, the bills are introduced. Senator Probansky, do you want to take the Senate side?
We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We have another process that we're going to do. I'm just going to put this as a caveat. We're in the process of introducing bills for the upcoming session of 2013. The rule that we have had in judiciary has always been that we will be one that would allow for bills to be introduced as a process to actually get the proposed legislation before whatever appropriate committee it's going to be. We understand that many of the bills, LCs, that we will be introducing today may not even go to judiciary, depending on what the president of the Senate chooses as to what path and what subject matter our committee has versus some other committee. As Representative Krieger has said, the same thing plays out for us. This is just a straight introduction of bills. No one is obligating themselves to support any concepts that are being introduced at this time. It is only a process to allow the bills to come forward. And the other part that I need to give the caveat, the vote for this will not occur until I give the president an opportunity to be here. He had other presidential duties of welcoming new members. And so when he gets here, that's my plan on actually taking the vote. Bill, if you'll be so kind to go ahead and read through the LCs that we do have.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have LC 86, dated September 4th, LC 189, dated June 20th, LC 190, dated June 21, LC 198, dated September 17th, LC 221, dated October 16th, LC 222, dated October 18th, LC 223, dated October 18th, LC 233, dated September 4th, LC 250, dated August 3rd, LC 304, dated October 19th, LC 305, dated August 10th, LC 419, dated August 23rd, LC 420, dated August 21, LC 423, dated August 21. August 448, dated November 17th, LC 449, dated August 30th, LC 457, dated August 22, LC 465, dated July 19th, August 745, dated August 17th, LC 746, dated August 17th, LC 747, dated July 19th, LC 748, dated July 30th, LC 749, dated July 27th, LC 750, dated July 26th, LC 751, dated July 27th,
LC 752 dated July 30th, LC 754 dated July 6th, LC 755 dated July 30th, LC 756 dated August 3rd, LC 757 dated July 30th, LC 763 dated November 15th, LC 764 dated August 24th, LC 842 dated August 12th, LC 907 dated December 7th, LC 921 dated August 16th, LC 922 dated August 31, LC 923 dated August 30th, LC 924 dated August 15th, LC 925 dated November 9th, LC 1101 dated November 20th, LC 1102 dated September 7th, LC 1103 dated September 7th, LC 1104 dated September 7th, LC 1105 dated September 7th, LC 1106 dated September 7th, LC 1107 dated September 7th, LC 1108 dated September 7th, LC 1208 dated December 6th, LC 1209 dated December 6th, LC 1227 dated November 21, LC 1417 dated December 3rd, LC 1418 dated December 4th, LC 1505 dated October 22nd, LC 1650 dated October 24th, LC 2733 dated November 14th, LC 2763 dated November 15th. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's it.
All right. Thank you.
Good question.
For
Bill, I just want clarification on date on LC 842. You said August 12th. It says on here the 16th.
That's probably right. 842 dated August 16th.
Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And the other one, what's the date on LC 1505? Is it the 26th?
October 26th.
Okay.
My
All right. Thank you for the clarification. Well, as I stated, we're going to hold the vote on this until we have an opportunity to give the president to join us. So we'll hold off on the motion. We're going to.
I have to close the judiciary.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close our work session, recess it, I should say, at this point, and we'll reopen it when we have other members here.
And I failed to close, so we're going to close the judiciary work session on bill introductions. And the House can open the informational hearing.
And the Senate will also open up its informational hearing on the topics for today. So at this point, everyone, we're going to have some informational hearings. The first one that we have set up for today is the report from the Patient Safety and Defense Medicine Work Group. I have three individuals. Hopefully everyone's here at this time. Richard Lang, Dr. Bud Pierce, and Gwen Dayton.
Here's my guy.
And thank you all for being here this morning and for your presentation. Oh, yeah. We should get the docs and the attorney sitting next to each other. A little more kumbaya.
I'm feeling good. All righty, so chairman, vice chairs, representatives, senators, it's a pleasure to be here. Happy Monday morning. We got a full week of work in front of us, and that's a great thing, isn't it? So
I'm Bud Pierce, president of the Oregon Medical Association,
and next to me on my left, I have Gwen Dayton, counsel for the Oregon Medical Association, my good friend and colleague. And on my right, my good friend and colleague, counsel Richard Lane, representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. So, Senate Bill 1580 had a liability reform component, and the governor put together a work group to try to help prepare some concepts to bring forward. And over on the easel, the black and white printout shows the governor's charge to us in preparing a proposal. And the main components were, number one, that the proposal would improve patient safety. Second, that the proposal would decrease the costs involved in liability and litigation, hopefully. And third, that we would have a decrease in defensive medicine costs if possible. So that's really our charge, the charge of our group. So we put together a legislative proposal of sort to go to the 1580 committee, and that That is actually found on the next flow chart, but it's hard for me to interpret flow charts because I get kind of busy. So I'm going to just kind of summarize it here, and my colleagues on my left and right will be able to expand on it, I'm sure. But the basic working idea is that when a serious medical adverse event occurs, that this would be reported to the Patient Safety Commission, and that they would utilize that data to examine the types of errors that are occurring and get it back to the medical community so that we have less errors. That's a good thing. The next step would be a rapid early discussion, disclosure that something bad had happened to the patient or their family, and to really let them know what we know about the situation at that time. Later on, after there's more time to fully sort out what really happened, because a lot of times when you're in the midst of a medical calamity, the information isn't complete. But later on, you go forward, and then you come back to the patient or their family and honestly present what you understand about what happened in the situation. And if indicated at that time, make an honest and fair offer. So that would be the next step. If that's accepted, great. If that is not accepted and the sides are close, it could go to mediation. And if mediation can bring the parties together that we're close, that's great. And if not, the standard litigation process is not changed in any way, and litigation can go forward. And I'm just going to close now, and then we're going to expand more on this. But as a practitioner, I look at this. I start with a couple phrases to think about as we look at this legislation going forward, if we can hopefully get there. The first is from Mao Zedong, and his comment: "The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." And we have a long way to go. We have a long way to go, and we're trying to take a first step. And Winston Churchill, this is not the end. This is not the beginning of the end. It may be the end of the beginning. Again, very apropos. We're a long way away from where we need to be. And where we need to be is you need to know where you want to know how to get there. And so let me say first where we are. So this morning I rounded at the hospital. I'm going to do this, participate in this presentation. I'm going to go back to practice. And where we are in medical errors is that the minute a medical error occurs, it becomes a legal event. It's not a medical error event. It's not a fix it and let's try to find out what happened and how to make sure it doesn't happen again. Right away, there's a tremendous fear in the system of the consequences of errors and really litigation. So right away, the system becomes very opaque. There's a quieting of the event. You're not to talk about it. And it's very controlled going forward. And then obviously, if it goes to litigation, it's very expensive to solve that. Where we need to be, where practitioners see where we need to go is if something goes wrong and there's an error, we need to be able to talk about it the minute it happens, hour after it happens, a month after it happens, 5 years after it happens, if that conversation will be useful in solving the problem and helping the people involved in the problem get past it, because there's a huge human toll when errors occur and you're involved in it. And we need to make it so that the monies that we put in as part of our liability premiums are primarily paid out to people who need to be compensated and not go into the cost of the system. So again, we know where we are, we know where we want to go. This kind of system has worked in the University of Michigan beautifully. The state of Massachusetts is moving toward this in a legislative way, in a statewide way. Interestingly, they did not pass death with dignity. They couldn't pass that, but they did pass this. And I believe that if we really pull together and keep our eye on the ball, which is make the system safer, and again, compensate people if there's injuries. We put money into the system, we can get there. And I'll close my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Prezinski and Vice Chair Krieger. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm with you all May, and you can't hear me.
Thank you.
I'll start again. Chair Prezinski, Vice Chair Krieger, I'm Gwen Dayton with the OMA. Thank you again for the chance to be here. I think Richard and I thought we might tag team a little bit some of the details of this, so I'm starting first, only because my portion of it comes first, not because I'm more special in any particular way. I wanted to talk about the first part of the process, which is really when a bad event happens in healthcare. And I use that term bad for purposefully, because we've defined serious event for purposes of the legislation, but certainly all of us, I think, are open for the most appropriate ways to define it. But the goal is, this is an event that shouldn't have happened. It's not a normal complication of care. It's not somebody who comes in already ill and doesn't do very well. It's those things that shouldn't have happened, that could have been prevented, and that caused serious injury. So if something like that happens, a notice can be filed, and it can be filed by the patient as well as the hospital or individual health care provider. And as Dr. Pierce indicated, the notice goes to the Patient Safety Commission as well as into the hospital if that's where the event occurred. It's important that it goes to the commission because there's a balance that we're all working on with this between open and honest conversation with the patient to encourage transparency with the patient as to what happened, but we need to protect that on some level, right, so that we can have that open conversation. So we want to ensure that patient safety is served as well as it can be. So we want the commission to be involved, take these reports, do its work, analyze them, distribute data information to providers so they can practice as safely as they can. So that's a really important part of this. On the other side, when a notice is filed, then that's when there's the opportunity for this early conversation with the patient, right? And that the legislation as it's currently put together is fairly broad and purposefully so that this early conversation can adapt to this particular circumstances. Sometimes this might be a really definable event. Everybody knows what happened. Let's just go talk to the patient about it, and if an offer is appropriate, let's do it. Sometimes it might be really complicated, and it's unclear exactly what happened, and those facts are determined over time. So the early conversation might be a little more limited with more conversation to come. It just depends on the particular circumstances. Now, those conversations can happen now, right? There's nothing preventing hospital representative providers from talking to patients about things that happen, and they often do. What's different about this legislation is it provides some level of confidentiality for the conversation, because right now, when that conversation occurs, everyone is pretty guarded because there is always the potential for litigation to arise out of it, and nobody wants their words, as well-meaning as they might be, to be used later in a circumstance that doesn't help them. So that's the negative about what we have right now, is there really isn't an incentive for anybody to be particularly open or transparent with the patient. So we're losing one of our goals right now, that is transparency, openness with the patient, helping the patient understand what happened. So we want this early conversation to be open and transparent. The malpractice carriers can be involved if they need to be. Again, it depends on the nature of the circumstance. Others can be involved in these conversations as is appropriate for the purpose of the conversation. So, an offer can be made. It doesn't have to be. But if an offer is made, then there's an opportunity to negotiate, to figure out what's appropriate. And if the offer is accepted, as Dr. Pierce said, that can be the end of it. But if either there's no offer made and the patient believes there should be, or an offer is made and it's found to be inappropriate by anybody, then there's the opportunity for mediation. So it's really a second opportunity to try to work this out. The whole point of this early conversation is two main points. One, or open the first part of this process, two main points: to promote patient safety with the commission and with openness with the patient about what happened, opportunity for the hospital, if that's where it occurred, or the individual provider to determine why this happened and try to prevent it from happening again and share that with the patient. So we've done that, but if the patient is not satisfied or the parties aren't satisfied, then there's the opportunity to go to mediation for one more opportunity to work this out before it goes into full-blown litigation, and that's where I think Richard's going to pick up our tale.
Thank you, Gwen. Senator Brzezinski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee, before launching into the mediation aspect,
Richard, I need you to put your name.
Richard Lane, behalf of the trial lawyers. Thank you, Senator. Before launching into mediation, I thought I'd take a moment just because as I look around, I'm not sure all of the committee members actually understand the process that got us here today, and I thought I'd take just a moment. Starting back in approximately March and April, the governor convened a small advisory group and actually kicked around in a lot of meetings, a lot of discussions about stuff that we've talked about for many years. And we heard from a lot of experts, read a lot of materials, and the genesis of what's in front of you began in that advisory group. The advisory group had a recommendation, made that recommendation to what we've referred to as the 1580 group. and that was four public members and four elected officials, Senator Przanski, Senator Cruz, Representative Garrett, Representative Conger, were the elected officials on the 1580 task force. We held a whole bunch of open hearings about the proposal, kicked around a number of other items. Some things were added, some things were changed as part of that process. And then the 1580 group, by consensus, adopted the governor's proposal, and that's basically what you have here outlined in the flowchart, and has actually been drafted now in what's referred to as LC 1305, which goes into a little bit more detail. The flowchart, you notice, refers to an administrative entity. That would be one example of how far we've come, that we've actually...
Mr. Chair, we don't have the flowchart. Has that been passed around?
It is not.
Well, he's referring to one.
It's right behind that chair down there. We can't see.
I know that. We
right,
can't see that. He has one in his hand. I wondered if he provided it for the committee.
Okay. We have not gotten it yet.
Sorry.
It's working its way around.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
You're welcome.
Right there. Way to go, Matt.
I was told it was going to be.
Richard Gordon.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. LC 1305 is a little bit more detail fleshed out. There's still some issues that need to be resolved. But the flowchart basically takes the concept and demonstrates what we're talking about in three phases of trying to resolve claims. You notice up at the top of the flowchart where it says administrative entity, that's one example of how far we've actually come, that we've actually identified now the Patient Safety Commission as an appropriate body to receive these notices that begin the process. And then at the end of the process, what the advisory group felt was most important was that data could be collected. And if there was an error that occurred in Portland, then Roseburg would find out about it. And there'd be the sharing of information across the state so that you wouldn't see a repeat of errors. You'd actually eliminate those errors from happening in other facilities around the state, thereby improving patient safety and reducing any type of claim because you're eliminating the error in the first place. So that the data will now go to the Patient Safety Committee and they'll be expected to do something to disseminate that information statewide. After the disclosure process, as described by Gwen Dayton, there is an opportunity for a mediation component. And that is, if there is an offer that has been extended, but the patient feels it is inadequate, then they can agree to go to mediation. If there is a process of disclosure and it's decided that no offer is appropriate under the circumstances, there could still be mediation if both parties agree to it. And the thought there was, as crazy as that sounded, sometimes it's not about the money. And an opportunity where the two parties can sit down and have a discussion may be beneficial to the overall physician-patient relationship and may eliminate the necessity of a claim being filed because somebody's dissatisfied with how they've been treated. So that's an option that's available to both parties if they agree, even if an offer is not made on a given claim. Once the mediation is concluded, if we have successful resolution of the claim, that is information is conveyed back to the Patient Safety Commission, and the case is obviously closed. If mediation is unsuccessful, then the path towards a litigation in a traditional sense remains available to the patient. That's the outline of the proposal. During the process of both the advisory group and the 1580 group, we heard from some national individuals that are involved, particularly University of Michigan. We've read some stuff about University of Illinois. We've heard about Colorado's COPAC, the largest insurer, is involved in a program very much like this. And as Dr. Pierce mentioned, Massachusetts, Governor Patrick signed a large transformation healthcare bill in July, and it was a component of this codified in that transformation bill. So that's the lay of the land nationally at this point.
In Washington, too.
And Washington is involved in a pilot project that they're getting off the ground that has similar components in it as well. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. We're going to open up the panel for any questions, any discussion. Representative Tomei first, Representative Wan second.
Thank you. Help me understand, is this a pilot project or is this going to be instituted throughout the state?
This is Gwen Dayton. This is intended to be statewide. It's not intended to be a pilot.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brzezinski and Representative Tomei, the governor, when he gave us our charge, he did want to treat the entire state equally, no matter what type of health care delivery one actually had. Everybody would be able to take advantage of this proposal.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is in... During the process of your hearings, did you make a determination about what exactly is the largest cost driver for these types of situations, be it the attorney's fees or large damages awards or punitive damages, et cetera? Were you guys able to make a determination about that?
Senator Brzezinski, Representative Wong. No specific finding was ever, but we actually, in studying sort of these proposals and whatnot, it was reported back to us that those that have experimented with these have seen a reduction in the number of claims filed and the cost associated with the liability component.
Quick follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. I haven't worked on a whole lot of these, but what I understand is that oftentimes the doctor has the decision-making power with respect to a malpractice claim regarding whether or not to settle, not the insurance company. And that understanding, if I'm incorrect, please correct me, do you have a comfort level that this will be successful if the doctors continue to have that unfettered power to just simply say no settlement, no offer, we're not going to be involved, and force it to trial?
Chair Brzezinski, Representative Wan, that's a very good point. One of the things in the current draft of the legislation is it says that while malpractice carriers cannot refuse to cover somebody who participates in this process, they can impose reasonable obligations on their insured, obligations that can interfere in a significant way with participation, but certainly that could, for example, require a participant, a physician or otherwise, to notify the carrier maybe when they file the notice, or to involve the carrier before they in any kind of offer determination. So I hear your point, and that will still remain. Nothing will change that existing relationship between a carrier and their insured in terms of who gets to consent and that. But the insured could require that the physician, for example, involve the insurance carrier as they go through this process.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Wisnett and then Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I wish you luck. I hope it works. I hope it brings down costs.
Okay.
Then, Mr. Chair, I have a question, I guess, for Senator Cruz or Representative Garrett or Representative Olson. Is this our tort reform that we pledged our support for the governor's health care bill? If it is, I'm disappointed. I hope this works. I hope it brings down costs. But I voted for that bill because we voted for that bill knowing that's not going to really reduce cost. It's going to control cost growth. And one of the things we had concern about was tort reform. And if this is all that the governor is presenting for tort reform, I'm disappointed. I told my people I was voting for the bill because the governor was going to give us tort reform. And if this is all we get, I'm disappointed.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we made a lot of progress in the three meetings that Senator Cruz and I attended. I should say you made a lot of progress. When we wrapped up, my understanding was we sort of had a basic framework. Some details remain to be worked out, and the drafting process began. Can you just kind of tell us are there remaining sticking points, and what's the status of those discussions?
Sure, Chair Brzezinski, Representative Garrett. There are a couple of sticking points that we're actively working out, and that's fine. And I would say, Richard, please add your own thoughts, but from the OMA's perspective, we're looking at mandatory versus voluntary. Many physicians would like this to at least start voluntary because it's untested and there's a lot of questions. And so that is something that the OMA would like to pursue with our firm commitment that we would pursue education of all physicians and encourage participation so that this really can have strong participation regardless of whether it's voluntary or mandatory. The Patient Safety Commission process actually is voluntary. That was established in 2003. And there's a lot of discussion then about should it be voluntary or mandatory, and that's a process where hospitals and other more institutional providers report adverse events. So it has a similar pathway to what we're talking about, and that started voluntary and has stayed voluntary, but their participation has grown steadily over the years, and we see that as a model for this program as well. Again, not as a statement that physicians won't participate, but more as a statement that as we sort of work through this and physicians and other providers understand it, let's not make it a required process. So that's one sticking point, because I don't know that there's necessarily agreement on that point. The second one is the confidentiality of the early discussion. It's important for physicians and other providers that they be able to be candid and open with the patient without fear that what they say might be used later. But we're having active conversations about how we do that effectively in a way that doesn't disadvantage any party, be it the patient, the hospital, the physician, or the later litigation process. So that is a sticking point that we're trying to work through.
Senator Brzezinski, Representative Garrett, members of the committee, I'd agree that those are the two ongoing sticking points, if you will. But the process has really involved sitting down, a lot of shuttle diplomacy involved by the governor's office in communicating with both sides, a lot of joint meetings, a lot of discussions, a lot of drafting, a lot of contributions by the elected officials that have been involved in this process. So the voluntary, and I'm not sure I like the word mandatory, but getting this thing up and running across the state as soon as possible is, I think, desirable. When we were drafting this, we realized real early on that actually signing a bill, if it was passed, and saying this is the new system starting right now would be burdensome to all of the participants. So really early on in the process, we took a look at that and we thought that if the bill passed, perhaps allowing a year for full implementation would be beneficial. You'd have an educational phase in, you'd be able to get operational, get the word out, have facilities be able to deal with this new process. Now there's sort of a little retreat from that. So we got to work that, make sure that it's not a trap for either the provider or the patients. We've got to take care of some things. We're still talking about that. The confidentiality, the governor's proposal had some exceptions inside it when it went through the 1580 process. There's been a little bit of retreat from that. Again, you want to actually make sure that all parties, both sides, patients, providers, are engaged in an honest communication, and that honest communication remains all the way through the process. So we just want to make sure that there's some sort of protection in there for both sides in the process. So we're working on that language as well, and we've had a number of thoughts about how to try to get around that.
Thanks, Senator. Maybe I can go back to the question on cost and what this represents in terms of liability reform. I've read a lot about liability reform, and for the last 25 years, we in medicine spent a lot of effort in trying to prevent medical errors or presumed medical errors from going to the courtroom, and we've been rebuffed pretty much every time. And it's clear that American society and Oregonians are not going to give us any relief unless we can come up with a viable alternative. And that's what we have to think about creating is we would like to make lawsuits rare in medical errors or disputes, not as the only mechanism to solve this. If you look at the University of Michigan data over the last 10 years, where they put a huge effort into this, and the reporting increased by 20-fold by the providers. That means providers developed confidence in the system. Their number of actual cases fell by 2/3. The amount of settlement per case went from about $433,000 to $200,000. And they were able to pull out about $50 million in reserves that they were holding for to solve cases and put into patient safety efforts. So if we don't come up with a viable alternative to this problem, we're just not going to get relief. And we need to do that, and we need to do better than what we have. And so this is a bold step. It's scary to everyone. The current system is despised by patients and doctors and hospitals. It's kind of okay with the people who are employed in the system. It is a system to try to compensate and have some fairness, although it's a very crude instrument. So we have to work on coming up with a new system, something else than what we have now. And if we don't, it's going to be rejected. And I really push hard to make this go forward.
All right, I got Representative Hicks and Representative Schaffler.
We have touched already on the confidentiality piece in regards, I think, mostly to the pre-mediation, though perhaps during even mediation, but could one of you describe the extent to which the rules of evidence apply, particularly to the mediation phase, but also to the extent that you're envisioning the application of the rules of evidence to even the pre-mediation phase?
Senator Pazanski, Representative Hicks, there's been a lot of discussion about how the existing evidence code and rules of civil procedure actually play inside of this process. And as far as the confidentiality, well, I'll take the mediation. We have taken a whole bunch of the mediation statutes that are already on the books that apply generally to mediation and incorporated them into the proposal. So that's that piece. Those would remain, you're familiar with mediation and the protections afforded with it. Those would slide in or be referenced as part of the mediation process. As far as getting ultimately to court, you're also familiar with Oregon Evidence Code 408, which is Office of Compromise, and those are generally considered confidential, subject to certain exceptions. That was part of the language that was in the first governor's proposal and went through the 1580 process, and that language is sort of still a focus as we continue to have our discussions at this point.
Got it. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a measure a few years ago that someone that was successful in a malpractice suit would have gotten, I think, all their medical costs paid for, all their lost wages throughout their life, and $1 million on top of that. And I think the argument against it was that, well, people would be denied their day in court because maybe there wouldn't be enough money in it for lawyers to take the case. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it barely failed, so I think people do want something done. But you specifically talked about this process is going to establish a system where you have an honest conversation throughout. Are today we not having honest conversations? Is someone being dishonest today in our current system? And if so, who and what are we doing about it? So it seemed to suggest that today people are not being honest. Is that the case, and who are they, and what can we do about it, and how is this going to solve that? Personally, I don't think this is going to solve anything, but that's my opinion. So are we having dishonest conversations now?
Senator Brzezinski, Representative Schaffer. No, I don't think that we're having dishonest conversations. I don't believe that. But we are encountering a certain amount of cost associated with getting to what happened. And that this proposal may very well eliminate some of those transactional costs. When I talk about the honesty component, I just want to make sure that the proposal that actually, if it gets passed, holds everybody to that same honesty, that there's not the opportunity for taking advantage of somebody who might be in a very difficult situation, that's unrepresented, that is being presented with something that may sound like a good deal at face, without really knowing the consequences. That's just the integrity of the process is what I'm actually trying to look out for, Representative.
All right, hang on, folks. We're getting beyond our time. This is just an update. We're going to have to take more of this up during the regular session once we get a little bit further. But I know that Senator Wissett, you had a quick question or comment.
Just one question quickly. I can understand how this could, you know, you could, this could be helpful after the fact. But how does this address the cost of defensive medicine? I'm sitting here struggling, trying to figure out how it had, how it even broaches that subject.
Thank you, Senator. When you look at systems that have put this into place, currently there hasn't been much impact on defensive medicine. There's still the fear of litigation. I think that as long as litigation is out there as a real fear, that there's going to be hesitancy in not doing what doctors and hospitals think they need to do to avoid being sued. I liken this as the 1,000-mile march or walk, and this is the first step. I don't believe this will solve that part of that. Although, again, one could imagine that over time, if people have confidence that that when medical errors or problems occur, that they'll be solved in a way outside the courtroom. You can imagine that the people will become less will become more confident, so they won't overtest, is what it comes down to. But right now, you'd have to say the data does not support a big impact on defensive medicine for this approach.
Senator Cruz, closing statements.
Yeah, thank you. First, putting this in the Patient Safety Commission is absolutely the right place to go. We've done some protections. We've protected this data from the national database, which I think is also critical. I want to thank the governor for putting money in his budget for this effort, because it was absolutely critical from our perspective that this be clean money, and the only way to have it clean would be make it general fund dollars. So as compared to the rest of the Patient Safety Commission that's fee driven. So, but the issue of discovery is still something we have yet to work out, pure and simple. And to assume that this is the end of the discussion on liability would be foolish for anybody to think that. But I do think, having sat in on all these meetings, that we are creating a platform and an environment that could potentially help a whole lot of people. And, you know, my main goal in all of this is I think people ought to know what goes on when they're in the hospital, pure and simple. And I think this will facilitate some discussions. And I think we're committed to trying to get a bill through this time. So we've got a couple little hurdles to overcome, but I do want to thank Richard, Gwen, Doc. You guys have done some fabulous work on this, and we will continue. Hopefully we can have something by February that we can all sign on to.
And I also want to thank the panel, and Dr. Pierce, especially for you and your colleagues, as well as Richard, you and your colleagues, the ones that actually were on the groundbreaking invitation and working with the governor. It has actually brought something forward, and I know that not everyone's going to be pleased or happy with what may be the end result, but I agree with you, Doctor. This is the first step, and it's one that's necessary to move forward, and we get out of the box that we've been in. This is something that I've been dealing with since my first opportunity to serve in the legislature back in 1995, and I know it was a problem before that. So I welcome the opportunity to have that, and I believe we will, in fact, move something forward. The two little areas that we still need to work on have been worked on. It's going to continue to be worked on, and I expect that we will, in fact, be successful. Thank you very much.
Just one more thing, Mr. Chair. What we're attempting here is culture change, okay? Culture change doesn't happen easily, and culture change can't be forced. It needs, which is what happened with the Patient Safety Commission. Everybody was really leery about that, and now look at the participation rate is almost 100%. So the culture change can happen.
Right. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
This time we're closed this informational hearing. And colleagues, we are running a little bit behind based on what we need to do, because we have a report that needs to come in on update on the elder abuse reporting and increased protections for elders informational hearing. So I'm opening up that hearing at this time. And the panel I have is Marie Cervantes and John Thompson. If you two could please come forward. And as they're coming forward,
We will be, I believe we have all of our speakers for the juvenile court dependency proceeding, which is a timed event, so we'll try to get that started as quick as we can.
Hope this works.
Thank you very much. Sorry for the rush, but if you could take time to introduce yourselves and then give us the report, that'd be wonderful.
Good try.
Chair Brzezinski, co-vice chairs, members of the committees. My name is Marie Cervantes. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. And I'm here with John Thompson, our deputy director, to provide updates for you on two provisions of House Bill 4084, that passed in the February session, as well as provide updates about our new office. And we have provided a copy of our second annual Adult Protective Services report for you to see. So those will be our updates today, and we'll try and move through those as quickly as we can.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do we have? Oh, it's in here.
Were there any questions before we get started? Okay. For 4084, there were two provisions that we need to report to you on, and I think you all have a copy of our report to the legislature that was dated September 24th of this year, and that provides a more robust discussion and update of those two provisions. One was around the core competency trainings for adult protective service investigators, and the other is around the call center concept for adult protection in Oregon. For the statewide call system, we are asked to look at a system where we could receive calls around the state in a comprehensive way. As it stands right now, we have around 36 county offices where we receive reports of adult abuse. While this process was occurring, we also became aware of the child welfare system, who was also looking at a comprehensive way to receive abuse calls, and they have over 48 offices across the state. So we joined those conversations to be able to talk about how we could better meet the needs of Oregonians who want to report abuse. They know where to call, they want to know what number to call, and we get them to the right place at the right time the first time. The objectives of the study were to create an efficient standard reporting practice, enhance the ability for us to have uniform screening tools, and a standardized process around safety assessments and decision making, allow for a dependable after hours reporting system, and neglect reporting abilities. Consider the option of a centralized screening system with one office or two offices where everybody is co-located together so that we have the proper supervision and oversight of screening and can watch for those calls coming in. We wanted to provide a dedicated call-in line for law enforcement and then facilitate increased collaboration between our local communities, law enforcement, and community resources. There were three options that were considered as part of the report that you read, and the potential benefits and risks of each option were weighed. There was a recommendation to move towards one centralized screening office, but there are some fiscal considerations that were considered, so what we're doing instead is moving forward with a 1-800 number for Oregon. The 1-800 number in Oregon would serve as a focal point for all abuse reporting, and that would include children, adults over the age of 65, individuals with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, and mental illness. The number would be an additional point of entry, and that means that the local offices would also receive those calls, and calls could additionally go to this 1-800 number if folks didn't know where to call. It would be a really public and visible number for people to know. Part of the challenges that we have right now with this number is finding a way to balance customer service with automation. Because as you know, when you call into an automated system and you press 1 and you press 2 and then you try to remember what you either press 8, people can get turned around in the system, and what they need is somebody to talk to report abuse. And that is very important because folks may not continue to report, or it might decrease their likelihood to report if they become frustrated with an automated system. So we're trying to work out some solutions to that problem. We had originally anticipated that we would have a system in place around the first quarter of 2013, and now we're looking at having it by the end of the biennium, of this biennium. So that is where we are at with the statewide call center. Are there any questions about that? Okay, I'll keep moving. For the training and continuing education curriculum for adult protective services, we are asked to look at a comprehensive system for investigations for adult protective services that included assessment and report writing and various aspects of investigations, and we have done that. We have pulled together all the investigation components for every entity that does investigations for vulnerable adults. And we also pulled in our national experts and national standards for adult protective services and have created a core curriculum for our adult protective service investigators. Our core competency training institute begins in January. Our first session is January 28th through February 1st, and there are 10 sessions slated for 2013. The other area we were asked to report back to you on is around the care provider training development. And this is similar to the core competency training that was required for adult protective services. We had a work group that convened in September of 2011 and compiled a list of no-cost or low-cost training for our care providers. And several partners made an increased commitment to conduct abuse prevention education for families and caregivers, with APS agreeing to track these activities on a quarterly basis. So for July through September of 2012, more than 3,454 people, including families, facility staff, home care workers, long-term care ombudsmen, law enforcement, emergency medical technicians, contract nurses, domestic violence counselors, and many others in the general public received educational outreach related to abuse prevention education. We have also established a dedicated caregivers resource page with the goal of populating that site with new and existing resources for our care providers, and the website is listed in the House Bill 4084 report that you all received. Questions so far?
I don't think so.
Okay.
You're doing well. Thank you.
John is going to share a little bit about our new office so you know about our new name and what we've been up to in that area.
Good morning, Senator Prozanski, members of the committee. I'm John Thompson, and I am the Deputy Director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. If I give Marie a chance to catch her breath. Just one note before I talk about the reorganization of the office. One parallel project that's been going on along with the Elder Abuse Work Group is the Adult Safety and Protection Team, which was formed by DHS in April of 2011. That group was a large group of involving many stakeholders from around the state in the field of adult safety and protection. And they worked for about 5 or 6 months and came out with a list of recommendations for improvement and strengthening of the adult protection system, excuse me. You will soon find that I have a stutter, so that's what's happening. So in addition to the work on the recommendations from the Elder Abuse Work Group and House Bill 4084, we have also been working on the recommendations of the Adult Safety and Protection Team. And we have a spreadsheet on all of those, and we would be happy to provide those to the committee if you think that would be helpful. So in March of 2012, what we did, what the department did was they decided to combine many different offices that had been conducting investigations of abuse of adults into one. What we had was a very fractured system, depending on the population that was being, that there were allegations of abuse of. We also had separate training systems for the investigators for all those different populations. There was and remains a rather fractured set of rules that guide how to do the investigations for different populations, and so I'm talking about the populations including people over 65, people with a physical disability, people with a mental illness, people with a developmental disability. They each have separate rules defining what is abuse and how the investigations should be conducted. And that also varies depending on where those people live. So if they live in their own home, the investigations are conducted one way. If they live in a particular kind of facility, the investigations are conducted in a different way. So the intent of this new office, called the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, also fondly known as OAPI, was to bring those together into one centralized unit that could coordinate the work of over 250 investigators around the state, working with many different populations into one coherent whole. So that was about, oh gosh, March to December, about 9 months ago that project started. It's been quite a project. You were speaking about culture change a little bit earlier here, and that's definitely what we're going through as we merge together different offices, different histories of how they conduct investigations, and of course as we work on the project of realigning the rules so that we can be more consistent with all populations in all settings. So that's an exciting project. One of the main things we've been trying to do is improve our relations with law enforcement, and working still on the provisions of House Bill 2442 for the establishment of multidisciplinary teams, which are teams consisting of everyone doing abuse investigations along with law enforcement, to coordinate on cases and ensure that those cases are responded to promptly and that the ones that need to get to law enforcement investigation and of course work their way through to prosecution. So that's been a success. We're now up to 83% of our counties having multidisciplinary teams up and running, and we're working very, very diligently on the rest of those counties. We've also established contact with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, also known as DPSST, which trains law enforcement staff from around the state, and are working on a combined curriculum in certain specific areas to ensure the best possible response to abuse cases. And also in April, as a part of strengthening the safety net, if you will, in April of 2011, we implemented a process to refer the names of reported perpetrators in licensed facilities to the background check unit here at the state for the most serious cases of financial, sexual, and physical abuse. Excuse me. And the intent of that, of course, is to use that information for staff that are employed by facilities around the state in a way that it hadn't been used before, to screen people out who have a history of abuse from being employed in a facility. So that is underway, and we're continuing to refine that process as we go.
John, I'm going to need you to wrap up because we are already.
And with that, I will wrap up. And if there are any questions, I'll pass the baton back to Marie and she can finish it up.
I'll finish it up. So you have a copy of the annual report that is meant to share with you and members of the public data and information around adult protection and what we see in regard to the type of abuse and the amount, so you have an idea and awareness around what's happening here in Oregon. I'll skip over the highlights, but I do want to leave you with a few key points. In closing, we know that elder abuse is related to illness and death. There are national studies that support that abused seniors are 3 times more likely to die prematurely. Elder abuse victims are 4 times more likely to go into a nursing home, and abuse victims utilize healthcare services at higher rates. Elder abuse is common and is very underreported. The standards are anywhere from 1 in 23 cases to 1 out of 44 for financial abuse and neglect, 1 out of 57. Almost 1 in 10 financial abuse victims will turn to Medicaid as a direct result of their own monies being stolen from them.
Jeez.
50% of people with developmental disabilities or mental illness will experience repeated physical or sexual abuse in their lifetimes. So freedom from abuse is critical to benefiting from services and living independent and productive lives in Oregon communities. We are aware that there's a great deal more for us to do to strengthen our system. We know we've made some significant progress in the last year, but we are committed to continuing to strengthen the adult protection system here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, John Marie. Thank you very much for bringing forward the update for the report. We look forward to continue to see the progress of the new agency or department to move forward in the sincere work that you need to do to protect our elders and other adults. So thank you very much. And colleagues, we're going to stand down for, need what, 5 minutes, Bill? For about 5 minutes to let the next presentation to get all the equipment up and ready to go. Again, thank you very much for being here. And if anyone has any questions on the follow-up, if you'll go directly to our presenters, and they'll be able to follow up with any questions you may have. Thank you again.
Thank you.
sir.
We're back on the record. I'm going to go ahead and open up the work session that we had recessed for the interim committee, judiciary committee, for the purpose of doing the introduction of the Senate Judiciary Committee bill concepts that have been read into the record. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the LC drafts delineated by Mr. Taylor earlier in our meeting as Senate bills be adopted as Senate bills.
Senator Cruz moves the previous listed legislative concepts to be introduced as committee bills. And as I stated on the record before, I think it's worth noting that this is just the process of introduction of the bill concepts. No one that is voting today to do the introduction is binding themselves to have any support for those measures as they work through the process. Is there any other discussion? If there's not, any objection? So ordered, it will be, in fact, those four, that list of legislative concepts that were read in the end of the record have now been introduced as committee bills. And we'll close the work session on the introduction of committee bills. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and open up our last of our presentations, which is going to be a presentation on the juvenile court dependency proceedings. We have three individuals that will be presenting today. So with that, we'll open up the proceedings. And Kip, I'm going to call on you if you'll do the introductions. And thanks for everyone for being here.
Well, thank you, Senator Brzozinski, and thank you, members of the committees, for the opportunity for us to present some information which we think is helpful in guiding policy and practice regarding child dependency cases. My name is Kip Leonard. I'm a senior circuit judge, which means I'm retired, and have been for a couple of years. The last 10 years or so of my time on the bench, I did almost entirely child dependency and child delinquency cases, and came to be very interested in the practice, and also took that position, as many other judges do, without a lot of specific training or knowledge in the areas that I was called upon to preside over and rule upon. To my left is Michael Livingston. Mr. Livingston is a former appellate counsel for the Department of Justice, juvenile referee in Marion County, and he is now the juvenile law staff counsel for the judicial branch. And to your far right and to my far left is Dr. Rohana Buchanan, who is a research scientist at the Oregon Social Learning Center in Eugene, and she is going to give the body of our presentation today and some information which we think is very important and something that we hope will assist all of you as you confront issues and deal with legislation this term that may touch on dependency and delinquency issues. The genesis of this work really was a interbranch work group on dependency issues that came together 4 or 5 years ago. Representative Krieger, Senator Cruz, you may have a better recollection of when that started, but the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, Dave Brewer, was instrumental in calling together representatives of the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the executive branch to discuss issues regarding child dependency. And this group has been it's been very informative, and it has done some very good work in exchanging information, and we hope has been some help in the past in guiding the work that you do. The purpose is to improve the policies and practices regarding children and families where there is abuse and neglect. One of the things I think that we've done is that we've informed ourselves that we were not well informed on a body of science that exists and continues to develop regarding the causes, the effects, and effective interventions regarding abuse and neglect. As I was approaching my retirement, I was certainly have been aware for some time in Eugene of the Oregon Social Learning Center, which is a nationally regarded institute agency that does research in areas of children and families. And since my retirement, I've been on the board and now am about to serve as the president of the board. And more I find out what I didn't know and what I wish I would have known during the time that I was on the bench. It is not just parenting by what we think, by the seat of our pants, by dealing with issues of abuse and neglect based upon our experiences that should direct our practices. There is now a very extensive body of science that the Oregon Social Learning Center is responsible for in large part regarding these issues. And Dr. Buchanan is going to share some of that today. The scientists at OSLC have been very gracious in sharing with a number of us, Mr. Livingston, Judge Brewer, myself, and others, as we have thought about ways to share this information with you, and then also take it to the judiciary, because that's where decisions are made after the policies that you consider are enacted into law. We are putting together a course for judges so that they can be exposed to this information in dealing with real-life scenarios. We believe that for judges and for legislators and for members of the judicial branch that we first must have a shared body of knowledge about what is going on in this research and what we can do. And it is very hopeful when you listen to what Dr. Buchanan is going to summarize as work that's done in this area. It provides a lot of hope that we can do a better job in providing for the children and the families where abuse and neglect occur. So we thank you for the opportunity to present this information. What we are going to do is have Dr. Buchanan give you a bit of an overview of some of the work that's being done, and then Mr. Livingston is going to provide for you a review of the legal framework within which judges and the legislature deal with these cases, so we can have some idea of where we may bring this information to bear on the work that we do here in the state. And I do want to single out and point out that Representative Krieger and Senator Cruz have been valuable members of the work group and have done a considerable amount of work in trying to do a better job for kids and families in this state, and we thank you very much for that work. Dr. Buchanan.
Thank you. What I'd like to show you today are some...
Doctor, I hate to do this, but I need you to go ahead and put your name on the record.
Okay. My name is Dr. Rahana Buchanan. I'm with the Oregon Social Learning Center.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you. So the information that I'd like to share with you today is in collaboration with the Oregon Social Learning Center, where I'm a research scientist, with the University of Oregon, with the Stress and Neurobiology Research Institute, and with the Center for Developing Children from Harvard University. And I will be reviewing some of the research that we've been collaborating on. So if you can just keep... There we go. So healthy development of the child is the foundation for our society. And if we have children with healthy development, I'm going to go back one. Thank you. Then that leads to our children being more educated, to economic productivity, responsible citizenship, and lifelong health. And these are the pillars that are necessary for successful parenting, strong communities, and a healthy environment.
Dr. Buchanan, I have members here. They're looking through their packets. I know you're going through the PowerPoint. Do you know if you provided the committee their own so they can do notes on, just so they know they actually have in their packet?
Senator Brzezinski, the first document in the packet are all the slides that we're going to be showing today,
okay.
And there are places for notes beside the slides. That should be the first document in the packet.
Well, we have one. The one I'm looking at is the juvenile court dependency proceedings. Is that the packet we're talking about?
That's correct.
Okay.
So at this time, I would like to show you a brief video. It's under 2 minutes, and it will highlight some of the brain architecture science that I'll be talking about later on. And can I get some help with the volume?
I just turned it down.
Thank you. So I'd like to show you this video and then I'll review it.
Do years of life have a lasting impact on the architecture of the developing brain. Genes provide the basic blueprint, but experiences shape the process that determines whether a child's brain will provide a strong or weak foundation for all future learning, behavior, and health. During this important period of brain development, billions of brain cells called neurons send electrical signals to communicate with each other. These connections form circuits that become the basic foundation of brain architecture. Circuits and connections proliferate at a rapid pace and are reinforced through repeated use. Our experiences and environment dictate which circuits and connections get more use. Connections that are used more grow stronger and more permanent. Meanwhile, connections that are used less fade away through a normal process called pruning. Well-used circuits create lightning-fast pathways for neural signals to travel across regions of the brain. Simple circuits form first, providing a foundation for more complex circuits to build on later. Through this process, neurons form strong circuits and connections for emotions, motor skills, behavioral control, logic, language, and memory during the early critical period of development. With repeated use, these circuits become more efficient and connect to other areas of the brain more rapidly. While they originate in specific areas of the brain, the circuits are interconnected. You can't have one type of skill without the others to support it. Like building a house, everything is connected, and what comes first forms a foundation for all that comes later.
So what this video is showing us is that the process of brain development starts very, very early on. And what science is telling us is that there are two very critical periods in a child's life for brain development. The first is during the first 3 to 5 years of their life. And during the first 3 to 5 years, they're developing these very, very simple skills. So a child cries, and the parent picks them up, and they learn to calm down and be soothed. And then more complex skills later on would be to be able to be patient under conditions of stress, to be able to self-soothe under moments of stress. And so we must have those initial early skills in order to develop those later more complex skills. So the cognitive, emotional, and social capabilities are what begin in the early life and then develop over time. And so clearly we need to have a strong foundation for our children.
Mr. Chair, I hate to interrupt, but we don't have this material.
Yeah. We don't have this material.
Yeah. Michael, we don't have it, so I don't know if it was supposed to be part of the packet. What we have is the PowerPoint for the proceedings in juvenile court. We're going to go ahead and go forward with the presentation, but if you can make certain at some point we could get that to the committee members, and I apologize to the committee members, you may want to take notes on the extra paper and come back to it later.
Send it to.
Yeah.
My apologies.
That's quite all right.
This slide highlights the economic impact of young children who've been disadvantaged. And what we're highlighting here is that the early years, the 0 to 3, that's the place where we want to put our money if we're doing preventative interventions for our children. Because as you can see here, over time, our investment becomes lower and lower. So those early years, we have much higher impact. And later on, job training, as you can see, is much lower impact for our children. So the next thing I'd like to show you, and I'd like to jump on this while we're getting those copies made for you, is a little bit about toxic stress for children. And so this highlights how those children who have been disadvantaged or have been abused or have been neglected often experience high levels of stress, much, much, much higher than what we've been experiencing, and that this is chronic and ongoing. And so in this video, we'll highlight the impact of toxic stress on children.
Learning to deal with stress is an important part of healthy development. When experiencing stress, the stress response system is activated. The body and brain go on alert. There's an adrenaline rush, increased heart rate, and an increase in stress hormone levels. When the stress is relieved after a short time, or a young child receives support from caring adults, the stress response winds down and the body quickly returns to normal. In severe situations, such as ongoing abuse and neglect, where there is no caring adult to act as a buffer against the stress response stays activated. Even when there is no apparent physical harm, the extended absence of response from adults can activate the stress response system. Constant activation of the stress response overloads developing systems with serious, lifelong consequences for the child. This is known as toxic stress. Over time, this results in a stress response system set permanently on high alert. In the areas of the brain dedicated to learning and reasoning, the neural connections that comprise brain architecture are weaker and fewer in number. Science shows that the prolonged activation of stress hormones in early childhood can actually reduce neural connections in these important areas of the brain at just the time when they should be growing new ones. Toxic stress can be avoided if we ensure that the environments in which children grow and develop are nurturing, stable, and engaging.
One of the highlights from this video are those neural pathways. And what I'd like to talk about for that is, let me get my slide back up, that the example I gave earlier where the child is crying and the parent picks them up and soothes them, those neural pathways are strengthened. But if the child is crying and they are not picked up, they are not soothed, or there are incidences of abuse, the ability to self-regulate, those neural pathways are pruned. And then those children are not able to self-regulate later on. So you have an infant who fails to learn to self-regulate, and then they go on into childhood and they enter the classroom where they have significant behavior problems, and then they fail to engage academically because they're not in their seat, they're not paying attention, they're not focusing, and then they're unable or more disadvantaged for their education. And this is not to say that stress in and of itself is a bad thing. We all experience stress. In fact, some levels of stress are considered a good thing for our bodies. So small amounts of stress, so maybe you're a little bit late to a meeting, or maybe your car doesn't start, or maybe there's a sort of a small incident that raises your blood pressure, and then your body is able to regulate that and bring it back to baseline. That is actually healthy for us. And we also have experiences with more moderate levels of stress, so death in the family, being in a car accident, these types of things, but they're sort of individual events, and we're able to cope with them, particularly for children who have these types of events, so a death in the family or sort of a large event, but it is individual. It's not chronic and ongoing. The most important thing is that often children would have positive relationships that would buffer the impact of the such stress. However, toxic stress, which is what we were talking about in this video, is chronic, it is ongoing, it is highly impactful. So if you have a child who's in conditions of abuse and neglect, maybe they have a dirty house, maybe they have abusive parents, maybe they are not being cared for, and this is ongoing, and it is creating a high level of stress. And what occurs is that the child is unable to regulate. They are flooded with stress hormones constantly. And what this does is it impacts their ability to develop. So children who are not developing typically because of this stress, they would have fewer of those positive neural pathways in their brains, their bodies don't develop, and their educational outcomes are disadvantaged. I'm going backwards there. So relationships are the most important thing. And so when we're looking at children and child welfare, it's very important that we look at the relationships that they have. So they may have negative experiences, but what are the other types of relationships they're having? Is there a protective adult in their life? And this is more or less what I said, but the more toxic stress they have, the weaker their brain architecture, the weaker the foundation, the neurological foundation they have for later skills in life. And so again, we must have caring adults because the effects of toxic stress are not simply that children can't perform well in school. It also has negative outcomes for later in life. So heart disease is increased, your risk for heart disease, and also for diabetes if you have such high levels of toxic stress as a child. Now I'll hand this to Michael.
Thank you, Dr. Buchanan, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, Representative Krieger, Representative Hicks, members of the committee. I was on the juvenile court bench in Marion County when I first heard this information, and I thought I knew a lot about...
Mike, if you move away from the mic, sorry, feedback.
I was on the bench in Marion County when I first heard this information. It was presented by an associate of Dr. Buchanan, Dr. Phil Fisher, and I thought I knew a lot about what I was doing, but this was stunning to me. One thing it did for me right away is made me think differently about the decision to remove a child from home. And also it made me think differently about decisions, how long a child should remain in foster care, when you can actually see the effect of the stress that Dr. Buchanan talks about on the child. So when you hear a report, when I heard a report on the bench that a child is doing fine in foster care, I heard that differently. I heard that to mean, well, the child may not be acting out, but a lot of this may still be going on, because one thing I learned was that the residual effects of that stress continue. The child, for example, maintains a constant state of vigilance, and unless that's addressed, this state of the brain architecture can just freeze in place, and the self-regulating, the things that we all do as a matter of course, just never develop. So this has a practical application at decision points in a juvenile court proceeding. That's what we're trying to bring to the training that we're working with the Oregon Social Learning Center to do with and for judges. It's impossible to think about that, for you to get that, I think, without knowing a bit about the structure of the juvenile dependency system, which the legislature has established. And I'd like to take you through that briefly, and to have Dr. Buchanan at the various decision points talk about how this science, this data, might inform our decisions better. And I think that as policy matters come before you, there are decision points for you too, because we're not talking about new programs. We're talking about using the resources that we have better and smarter. And thankfully, we have the data to support those decisions. When the state intervenes in the parent-child relationship, it can't intervene just because the state, the court, or DHS thinks it would be a good idea, or thinks that, well, the state could do a better job than the parent. The parent-child relationship is protected by the 14th Amendment. This legislature has established as a matter of policy that children have certain rights, stated in the statute, and you have a copy of that in your packet, and that parents have a responsibility to provide a home so that those rights of the child can be respected and protected. Those rights are right to permanency with a safe family, freedom from sexual, physical or emotional abuse or exploitation, and freedom from substantial neglect. What's missing from that, and it's implicit in what Dr. Buchanan said, is the freedom from that stress and the impact on the brain development that the violation of those rights cause. This is a policy statement that the state, through its courts and all its agencies, will respect that relationship. Before we get into each of the types of hearings and where these decision points might come up, there are some general considerations to keep in mind about the juvenile court system. One is the idea of jurisdiction, which means the authority of the juvenile court to act in the lives of parents and children, and to direct the agency, DHS, to act to improve those lives. There has to be a factual basis for that jurisdiction. The most frequent grounds for jurisdiction are those that are set out in this slide. The second is more obvious, because it deals with deprivation of physical, mental, and the basic needs of the child, or also unexplained physical injury. The first is more general. The conditions and circumstances of the child endanger the child's welfare. Let me read you a description of an actual case that comes under that jurisdictional basis. The mother allows the child to attend school in soiled clothes. This is a 12-year-old child. Clothes smell of urine. The child arrives at school with very poor hygiene, as exhibited by unwashed face and hands, unbrushed teeth, not wearing feminine hygiene products when needed, wearing dresses without underwear. The mother allows the child to attend school without eyeglasses that she needs. The mother did not immediately seek medical attention for the child when the school and DHS notified the mother that the child was in persistent pain. And the child is a past victim of sexual abuse and she's not participating in therapy. That totality of circumstances, according to the Court of Appeals, are conditions and circumstances that endanger the welfare of the child. Dr. Buchanan, having heard that description, is that one example of the situation that you're talking about that would affect that child's brain development?
That's exactly the type of situation that we're talking about.
And say if that child is 12 years old, if that stress is not addressed, even if these other things are, what's the outcome going
to
be?
The outcome is that it's likely that this child is less able to self-regulate, that they would have probably poor social skills and would be gravitating towards other children with poor social skills, would not potentially have strong employment outcomes, mm-hmm.
So
potential mental health problems.
In Oregon, any person can file a petition alleging that a child is within the jurisdiction of the court. If the child is an Indian child, the federal law, Indian Child Welfare Act, imposes higher standards of proof and placement preferences and priorities. These are the parties to juvenile court dependency proceedings in Oregon. The child, the parents, the putative father, the CASA, state represented by the DA or AG, DHS, the tribe when the ICWA applies, the juvenile department, and any intervener. That's a person who's not listed in that group, but who, for special reasons related to the case and because it's in the best interest of the child, may be given party status by a juvenile court.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Real quick question. I thought we had grandparents. I thought we passed a bill that said grandparents are also part of
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, grandparents are not parties, but on this slide, as you can see, under current law, this is the second paragraph up there, grandparents have the right to be notified of a hearing if they ask in writing for DHS to notify them, and they also have a right to have an opportunity to be heard. Foster parents have that same right to notice an opportunity to be heard, but as you notice, the foster parents don't have to ask for notice. The grandparents under the statute do have to ask in writing to be notified of a hearing. One thing we have done in the Juvenile Court Improvement Program for the Judicial Department is include in all of our standard judgment forms a prompt for the court to make the inquiry whether the grandparents have been notified and a finding whether they were given an opportunity to be heard. And that's part of our training. Same thing with the foster parents.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
At the beginning of a juvenile court case, even though the roles of the parties might be different, the goals by statute are the same, and that is to reunify the parent and the child as safe into a safe home as quickly as possible or within a reasonable time. And that's even if the child is in the home, to help the parents remove the basis for jurisdiction. For example, the situation that I described earlier. These are the hearings in the normal juvenile court process. The case can end at any stage. It doesn't have to follow all the way through. But as you can see, shelter, that's the very initial hearing, all the way through termination of parental rights. Even though the law is somewhat complex, there's a single question to be answered at each hearing. And hopefully, with more information that we have today from the Oregon Social Learning Center, we're able to make those decisions, answer those questions in a more informed way. Under Oregon law, if a person reasonably believes a child, if this is a police officer or a DHS worker or really any person, believes the child's welfare may be endangered, the police officer and the caseworker can take the child into protective custody. The law requires that that child be returned to the custody of the parents unless there's probable cause to believe that doing so will cause immediate harm to the child. If that child is not returned to the parent, the juvenile court has to hold a shelter hearing in the case within 24 hours that's what the shelter hearing is all about. And the question at the shelter is, can the child be safely maintained in the home before we can have a trial or hearing on the petition? Senator Cruz.
Yeah. One of the points I've been thinking about, because we're talking about the legal process, we've already put a stress on the child by removing them from the home in the first place, which is maybe one of the bigger stresses we put on them, especially young children. And the police and DHS do that under the term threat of harm, which has never been defined in any adequate way. I was wondering if you folks, with your infinite wisdom, could... I've always thought we should have a checklist of things. If A, B, and C are happening there, then we remove the child. If what I would like to have something a little more definitive than just this ambiguous threat of harm as a reason to remove a child from a home in the first place. This is a bit off subject, but still, I do think it speaks... It speaks to the thing because, you know, we have already stressed this child by removing them from the home. For whatever reason, the caseworker has determined, in most cases, probably legitimate, but I don't think we have anything defensible at this point in time. Comments?
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, the threat of harm is a sort of a shorthand, non-legal term, and that's I'm not judging your use of it because it is quite broadly used. The statute says that in order to keep a child in protective custody, that the person taking the child into protective custody must have, quote, probable cause to believe that the welfare of the child or others may be immediately endangered by the return. That's not threat of harm. That's a probable cause is a term that's used in criminal code. So that's not to say that couldn't or shouldn't be more specifically defined.
Right. No, I know probable cause in most cases is a high standard, but if we're determining probable cause still on some relatively vague gut reaction to a situation. You know, I do believe there are more kids removed from the home in Oregon than
I think. Yeah, I was going to say
per capita than any other state, and you got to question why.
I think the issue, though, is that if you start putting together a list, you're not going to be as inclusive as you may need. So I can understand having some guidelines of saying certain things, but you still are going to have some type of a broader perspective because you can't list everything that could potentially be.
No, I understand, but I do know that some states do have a more definitive terms that they use than Oregon does.
If I could respond briefly, Senator Cruz and Senator Brzezinski, I think, Senator Brzezinski, you touched on what I was going to say, and having done this and did this for a dozen years, there's the conflict or the two approaches. There can be a quantitative approach. Do you have this, 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 and this? But then that you also need to take a look at a qualitative approach. Mm-hmm. And what is the nature and the extent of the abuse and neglect? And I can tell you it's difficult. You can either cast a net that's way too wide or you can the net can come up empty when you should be capturing an abusive situation. So it is difficult. And that's why... We're here because we think that there needs to be more information and more knowledge about the dynamics of abuse and neglect than we've had in the past. And one of the things that I neglected to say in my opening comments, and I want to make sure I have a chance, so I'll take it now, and that is that I speak for myself, and I think I speak for many other judges. We spend an awful lot of time in dependency cases, once the cases come to court, on the reasons that the abuse and neglect occurred. What are the deficits of the parents? And certainly we have to pay very close attention to the deficits of the parenting, because that's what caused the situation. But we also need to have a sharper eye on the effects of the children, on the effects on children, and what is happening with them developmentally. We can't just assume that by taking children away from an abusive or neglectful situation and working with a parent's drug problem, that those parents then can necessarily meet the needs of the children. We need to have a better understanding, as Dr. Buchanan has begun to share with us, the effects of abuse and neglect.
and also to be able to anticipate what the needs of the children are going to be as either the family is continues to move forward united, or you're going to reunite a family. What are the effects on the children and how we deal with those? Because one of the things that we do know, and I think we all have experienced, is that there is unfortunately oftentimes a generational effect to abuse and neglect situations. So I want to make sure that what we're trying to do here is show that along with working with parents, we need to be much more mindful about how children are experiencing this and what it is doing to them, because they are not, you know, they're not going to be just fine because we've intervened. It's a little bit more complicated.
All right.
Thank you for the
time. I know a number of people want to say something. Let me go with the queue of what I got right now. Okay. I've got Senator Wissett. I think he wanted to say something. I got Representative Krieger and then Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I want to touch on the concept, DHS's concept of founded cases, because too often a case goes to court, the court finds nothing amiss, the child goes back to the parent, and then the DHS maintains this founded case in their files essentially forever. And it hangs as a specter over the family, as being more closely surveilled, being afraid that if they do anything untoward at all, they will be jerked back into court. And I think that's something that causes an unneeded and unnecessary and severe stress on families after they've been adjudicated. Could you comment on that?
I can attempt to comment on that, because that's the spectrum of cases that you may see in that area is very, very wide. I can certainly understand the situations that you talk about, where families have been branded, have been labeled by the fact that a case has been filed against them, there has been a report. But I can also share with you experiences that I've had when there wasn't enough evidence to be able to substantiate abuse and neglect, only to have the case come back later at some time. And people are going, why didn't you do something the first time? Because we now have a tragedy. It is inexact. How to measure this is inexact. How people present is oftentimes a situation. Just to give you the extremes. A friend of mine was forcefully putting his 2-year-old son into a car in the Albertsons parking lot, and somebody reported him. He's a wonderful father. So the next day, his gets a visit from DHS, and I was in private practice at the time. He called me up and told me, and I said, you know, it was a very concerned citizen who saw something that he thought was abuse and neglect, and it was a difficult 2-year-old who wouldn't get in the car. The young man is now in his 30s and he's doing just fine. On the other hand, I had the unfortunate experience of having presided over one of the most difficult abuse and neglect cases that we've had in Lane County and probably in the state, and it was a murder by abuse by a mother. That case was one where there had been reports made, and the reports were not, there was, they could not substantiate because of any number of reasons what happened, and it turned into a tragedy that none of us ever want to ever have to consider. So somewhere in between there lies a situation where perhaps the report that has been made is going to be helpful in the future in having a family offer the services and the help that the state may be able to provide. We unfortunately are always, it's like anything else, where we are dealing with reported behavior as opposed to behavior that is witnessed by an impartial third party. So, Senator, I share that concern that you have, and I imagine that you have heard from any number of constituents who have had an unfortunate situation happen to them, where they have had a referral made and it is unfounded, And they feel as though they've been branded and targeted. I'm not sure what else we do about that. What we're trying to do is to protect children from the kinds of things that Dr. Buchanan is telling us about, and it is less than perfect. And that's why the bringing to bear on these difficult situations, what we now have, as we can refer to as science and not social science or parenting folklore or judicial folklore or practice, but actually have science on our side and taking a look at these situations is something that we think is going to be helpful and is going to improve the practices for families, for children and adults. So that didn't answer your question, but it maybe gave you a little bit of the context in which these situations arise.
Representative, thank you, Chair. You talked about toxic stress effect on brain development, and then they're not able to self-regulate. Do you relate that to some way 70% of foster kids end up in the criminal justice system? So connect the dots for me.
Dr. Buchanan, you want to?
In my experience, I've worked in juvenile justice for several years, and in my experience, many of the children who come in to the juvenile justice programs do have child welfare contacts as well. So that definitely does happen. And the other thing that I would say about that is that, as sort of going back to what I said earlier, children who have a difficulty self-regulating have a difficulty making positive peer associations, and they tend to associate with delinquent peers, who then they can learn other delinquent acts and commit crimes together.
If I can add just another piece to that, Representative Krieger, and this may be jumping ahead because we also want to talk a bit about what are termed crossover kids, kids who start in the dependency system and then end up in the delinquency system, where they commit crimes. In the delinquency system, we've gotten smarter in how we deal with kids. It used to be back when some of us were of the age where we might have found ourselves having made a mistake. I know you, Senator Cruz, you never did, but I did. So
yes, he
let me
still does.
For, any disclosures
that may
the juvenile systems. Juvenile delinquency systems tended to take anybody and everybody and treat them the same. And so somebody who was the student body president and went out and got caught for doing some stupid prank would find themselves in the same situation as some kid who perhaps wasn't doing very well, the kind of person that Dr. Buchanan has described. Well, in the world of delinquency, one of the big changes in the last decade or two is to focus on high-risk kids. High-risk kids are kids that are likely to come back over and over and over again. Low-risk kids are kids that got in trouble and they self-correct. It's like, thank you, I'm awake now, and that's, and we don't see them again. One of the things you don't want to do is you don't want to mix low-risk and high-risk kids, because if you do that, they have a contagion factor, and low-risk kids then tend to become higher risk. So how do you figure out high-risk kids? Because you're going to get high-risk kids, medium-risk kids, low-risk kids who commit offenses. But you want to focus on high-risk kids. So how do you figure those out? And there are any number of assessment tools that are used. And people are making a living on developing assessment tools. And so some take hours and hours to complete with kids. Well, one of Dr. Buchanan's colleagues at OSLC, Dr. Patty Chamberlain, summarized all these assessment tools, and it's pretty interesting as we look at dependency cases. If you're in trouble, if you have a kid who's in trouble, and that young person has three or more of the following six risk factors, and they're in trouble, they are high risk. And these risk factors are in no particular order: whether their mom's ever been arrested, whether their dad's ever been arrested, whether there's been a major family transition, the kind of thing that Dr. Buchanan was made reference to in one of those slides, whether there's been a documented child protective services, a dependency referral, whether the child has a learning issue in school, whether the age of first arrest is under 14, If you have three or more of those and you're in trouble, you're high risk. Well, think about what the common denominator is in all of that. The common denominator is family. The common denominator is what has occurred as this child has grown up. And these, another way to look at it, I would think, I haven't asked Dr. Buchanan until now, I mean, wouldn't you think that these are children who have had episodes of toxic stress in their lives?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So as we talk about this whole, this, and I'm taking way too much time, I apologize, I'm going to shut up, but not until I make these points. As we talk about dependency cases, abuse and neglect cases, and we talk about delinquency cases, they're not two things. It's generally a continuum. Right. And as Dr. Buchanan was saying, if you want to deal with kids who have all of these toxic stress issues, you deal with them at the front end. And as all of you, as members of judiciary committees, look at issues of crime, let me throw one other thing out for you. And that is the age at which people commit the highest number of crimes, people who are criminally involved, is 17.9 years. At least that's the last statistic I saw. And if you look at it, if this is 0 and this is 60, you go from 0 to about 18 years like that, and then it ages out. And so if we want to deal with children who have toxic stress, as Dr. Buchanan said, let's do it when they're, 0 to 3. If we want to have an impact on criminal behavior in our communities, why do we wait and spend so much money at the, for somebody who's 26 years old in prison, when we could have looked at them as a youth, maybe 0 to 3, maybe when they're 14 or 15, and we are going to have had a lot greater effect socially, individually, and we're going to have a lot greater effect on those things that we're concerned about, abuse and neglect and criminal behavior.
So. Representative Krieger, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, in your packet, there's a study of Oregon children that was released in July of this year. That study says about these crossover children who are in the child welfare system and the delinquency system, these facts. Number one, 1 out of 5 children who come into the dependency court for abuse, sexual abuse, and I think domestic violence has a 1 in 5 chance of ending up in delinquency. And of those that do end up there, they're going to have more delinquency referrals for more serious offenses, and they're more likely to age out of foster care. Now, at least 2 counties in the state are taking that information and using it in their court system. Multnomah County and Marion County are flagging these so-called crossover cases, and among other things, having the juvenile probation officer and the caseworker appear at each other's hearings. There's a step before that, I think. As I read this report, I noticed that they also enter the dependency system at a higher age. So if I'm a juvenile court judge and I have a young girl or a young boy who comes into my dependency court who's 10 or 11 years old, a victim of physical or sexual abuse or exposed to domestic violence, I'm going to see that child differently based on this data, because I know that that child has a 1 in 5 chance of ending up in delinquency court, and once that child is there, of having more referrals for more serious offenses. So there's something the court can do now with that data that we have, and it's another example of using the science that we have to inform our decision making to look at children differently. There's a mother that I saw a lot in juvenile court, not the same individual, a type of mother, and it was a mother described as a child, just what I just described, physically, sexually abused as a pre-adolescent, began to use drugs and act out in delinquent behavior as an older adolescent. Methamphetamine was usually the drug that he or she came to. And the psychological diagnosis was depression, PTSD, and the person was self-medicating with methamphetamine, and that was the mother of a child that I had in court. And so not only do you keep that 1 in 5 out of delinquency, I think, but you keep that child from growing up and being a mother of a child who comes back in dependency. So there's a real history here, and the connection with the data, what we can learn from this science, is enormously important. As I said earlier, it doesn't require new funds. It requires new inquiries, different questions about the people we see in front of us every day. And I think it translates as easily to the work that you do as the work that the court does.
Yeah, thank you. And Chair Krieger introduced me to all this in 2005, and it's been some of the most painful yet rewarding work I've done as a legislator, but I won't miss these kinds of conversations. You talk about the toxic stress. I grew up in a very, I'll gladly self-disclose, my brothers and I were the worst trouble you could get in Webb City, Iowa. I'm grateful I grew up in a small town. My mother was schizophrenic. It was less than pleasant environment. You could probably check most of those boxes for all of us. And when my daughter was born, I promised her I'd never raise a hand in anger to her, and I never did. Looking back, I wish I would have never raised my voice to her, too, because she's incredibly brilliant, thriving at the University of Oregon. I brag about her every chance I get. And I will shut up in a moment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for sending her to Eugene.
My question, though, these parents, in all likelihood, are clearly suffering from toxic stress too. So you're going to fix a child, great, and I catch them early and fix them and square them away. So what about the parent that is not self-correcting? Mm-hmm. How can you fix that person, or are they just broken for good, or what do you do there? And it could be the grandparents are broken too. So what are you going to do about all that?
There are a continuum of interventions that can be done. If you have from all the way from 0 to 3, all the way up into adulthood. And for much of this, you know, there are mental health interventions that can be done, but a lot of it comes down to changing the parenting skills the parents have. And later on, I'll talk a little bit more about this, but one of the things, like the most predictive thing that a parent can do to change their child's behavior is to be more encouraging with their parent. And so in terms of reducing that toxic stress, it might be that they need to have therapy to address the PTSD potentially or the other mental health symptoms that they have, so that then they can be more encouraging and they can apply the parenting changes to their children.
And one last thing. I've had this conversation with my friends here about the definition of threat of harm. The last thing, I just met with a constituent, actually from Hillsborough, not my constituent, who was falsely accused, and I can't imagine the amount of stress. But the last thing, I agree with the Chair Posansky, that I don't want to create any loopholes that let any of these animals off the hook. That would be the worst thing we could possibly do. So I hope you tread carefully and lightly when you're doing that. Thank you, though. Appreciate the work you're doing.
So there is an opportunity at this shelter hearing to enter the kind of decision-making that we've just been talking about, because we know, as Senator Cruz mentioned earlier, about the stress of removal and the stress the child is already under. And that's why when we do trainings for judges and stakeholders in juvenile court, we put this question up. And it's not a rhetorical question. It's an inquiry to have the people who are in court saying this child needs to be out of the home until we can have a hearing on the petition, that they really articulate and make the case for that, in large part because we know the effect that it's going to have on the child and on the family, and also because you're operating on, often it's within 24 hours of the protective custody, very limited information. At that hearing, the parents and the child must be given an opportunity to give evidence that the child can be maintained safely in the home pending adjudication of a petition. Now, the case may end right here if the proper inquiries are made. Let me give you an example. Many children come into a shelter hearing or taken into protective custody because of an unsanitary house. The house is, you know, you've all heard the stories or maybe even seen the tapes of this. And you get to the shelter hearing in 24 hours, the house is cleaned up. Is it okay then to send the child back home? The hard part of that is determining why is the house in such terrible shape. Is it in terrible shape because the parent was ill and the other parent was out of town working? Or is it in terrible shape because both parents are addicted to drugs and that's just the way the house goes? Or is there a mental health problem? So you have very limited information, make very difficult decisions, but unless you make the folks and everybody in court or really articulate an answer to the question, why can't the child go home today, then someone is deferring to somebody else's judgment or impression about what's going on in the case. And I think it's not possible to delineate every fact circumstance. You can't do this by checkbox, but by training and elevating the thinking of the people involved and not deferring, having the judge be an inquiring magistrate, not just an umpire, you know, doing the judicial oversight and having everybody come up to that level of inquiry. That's how you make the corrections, not by, I think, legislating by anecdote, if you will, because you'll never have enough anecdotes to fill out a comprehensive list. If the child is maintained in foster shelter care, continued in shelter care, the agency has to make the case that they've made reasonable efforts or active efforts in an Indian Child Welfare Act case to eliminate or prevent the need for removal of that child, and then diligent efforts to place the child with a relative.
Bill?
Sure. Senator Brzezinski. Michael, could you explain the difference between active efforts and reasonable efforts?
Just stump the judge.
This is a rhetorical question. Senator Brzezinski, Representative Krieger, Council Taylor. Reasonable efforts is a standard. First of all, it's in statute, but it's also a standard that comes from the federal 4E funding source for foster care, and the agency has to make a reasonable effort, so-called, to prevent or eliminate the need for removal of a child and then to return the child. Active efforts is in the Indian Child Welfare Act case, and I don't think there's been much energy at the federal level talking about the distinction between those two. The state is forced, in effect, through its courts to delineate a difference. The appellate courts of Oregon have said active efforts is more than reasonable efforts. But they say that reasonable efforts are those efforts that are required by the circumstances of an individual case. So it's not very difficult to find an individual case that's not governed by the Indian Child Welfare Act that would apply the same level of efforts. An example would be if you had a case with a non-Indian parent who was cognitively limited, reasonable efforts to provide transportation in that case may require the caseworker to actually tell the parent how to get from here to there and sometimes even make the transport. And that's an example also that's given in an Indian Child Welfare Act case about what active efforts are. Most people think about it, I think, in terms of quantity of effort. And I think that's a very difficult calculus to apply. That's from having to try to distinguish it when we have questions like Mr. Taylor just asked. Once you begin to say, well, what does that look like, then it's very hard to come up with a principled way to distinguish them. But the starting point is one standard comes from the federal law primarily that applies to foster care funding. The other comes from the Indian Child Welfare Act, largely in response to evidence and findings by the Congress of the United States that over years before that act was passed, state agencies across the country did very little, if not nothing, to reintegrate Indian children into their families. So it's trying to find a distinction between two terms that really were never harmonized and came out of different contexts. I hope that's not too confusing.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. And my understanding is that our courts have determined that they're not the same. Active efforts requires the department to do more than it would otherwise do under reasonable efforts.
Chair Krieger, Chair Brzezinski, that's the way the court has analyzed it, including the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court, that it requires more than reasonable efforts.
Thank you.
So briefly, what I would like to say here is that, as the slide says, not all children have negative effects from toxic stress. Some children are buffered from a variety of factors, including primarily contact with a positive and caring adult, so a teacher, a pastor, another family member, a neighbor, somebody else who's there to provide support and encouragement to the child. Studies of preschoolers in child welfare have indicated repeatedly that they have different brain functioning overall than children in typical from typical families. And one of the things in particular that we've noted in some of the science that we've done is that when you give a correction to a child in foster care, their brain is activated differently at a lower level than a typically developed child. And this is potentially due to that flooding of stress hormones that has depressed their entire system, and so they are not responding. And so oftentimes when we have children who have difficulty regulating, when they're given corrective feedback, they then struggle to encode that and apply that later on. Fortunately, there are interventions that we can do to support these children, and there are some of the studies that we've shown is that children potentially, so preschoolers in treatment foster care, they've shown that when they came into treatment foster care, they had lower brain activation during corrective feedback activities, and that after several months of treatment foster care, their brains looked pretty much the same as typical populations.
You might explain what treatment foster care is, which is a different slice of foster care itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So treatment foster care provides a lot of support for the foster family, and in particular a very structured system where they can provide contingent reinforcement and encouragement for positive and pro-social behavior that would be calm, limit setting, and appropriate discipline. Consistent discipline, so not one time you mess up and your parent yells at you and the other time maybe they laugh, but every single time you do a small thing that's a problem behavior, then they would correct that. Also, it would include separation from delinquent and poorly skilled peers.
And I should have added earlier, we were talking about the stress of removal, that the Department of Human Services now, for some years, has had an initiative to safely reduce the number of children in foster care, and they currently have an initiative called Differential Response, and that's to take a better and different and closer look at those removal situations, or those situations that would result in removal, perhaps under an earlier or different standard. And I'm not capable of going through the details of that, but I wanted to alert you to that. I'm sure that the agency will be presenting that as they appear before you, but that they are looking at this too. I think in part at least recognizing in recognition of this difficulty of that the children and families experience when there's removal, and so they do have an initiative underway called Differential Response to address that. If there is a petition filed and still ongoing, when it's time to adjudicate it, there is a jurisdictional hearing, and the question is a child within the jurisdiction of the court? For non-Indian children, it has to be proven by a preponderance of the evidence. An Indian Child Welfare Act case requires that it be proven by clear and convincing evidence, including evidence with expert testimony that leaving the child in the home is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. So in Oregon, there must be a requirement of a current risk of harm. If you remember the example I gave about the unsanitary home, let's say at the time of the jurisdictional hearing, the house is clean, there's no evidence of drug abuse or drug dependence or mental illness or any other factor that's likely to have that repeated, there's no current risk of harm to the child, that petition would be and should be dismissed. And there's a substantial body of case law on that. Jurisdiction, if it is found, does not mean foster care. That is a misunderstanding. The juvenile court can have jurisdiction in a case, provide services, order services for a family without having the child be placed in foster care. Whether the child should be placed in or remain in foster care is a second decision that the court has to make. If the child is placed, found within the jurisdiction of the court must next determine what assistance the parents need to address the basis for jurisdiction. And these are the matters to be addressed and resolved. And I put whether the child's needs placement and legal custody. Who should have legal custody of the child? Legal custody can go to either parent, can go to another individual, or can go to DHS or another agency. You know, our model, what we're used to is the legal custody to DHS, but that's not the only option available to the court. Dr. Buchanan.
So from a science perspective, going back to some of the questions that Michael is talking about here, the first is, can the child be safe and healthy in the home? And this goes back to this idea of, from a science perspective, what are the conditions in the home? Is there contingent and encouraging parenting occurring there? Children who can predict their environments are more likely to have positive development. So then if the child is removed and there is potential for stress related to the child's removal, there would be some considerations, again, for where they are placed. So depending on the needs of the child, depending on the impact of that toxic stress, how significant that is, they might need different levels of care once they've been moved out of the home. Some of these children might have special needs. Others might not be showing such effects from the toxic stress. The duration and nature of the visit with the family is another thing to consider. Where are we having those visits? Is it a one-hour supervised visit in the DHS office? Is it in the community? Is it in the home? What is appropriate for the child? And if it is indeed occurring at the office, what types of things are the parent or parents doing with the child while they're in those visits? This is definitely an opportunity for them to practice some very positive parenting skills if they have some support for that. And then again, how does the parent demonstrate and document progress? Oftentimes, it's important to consider ways that the parent can show that they're using their parenting skills, that they're demonstrating, I went to my parenting class, and not only did I attend, but also I am now applying the strategies that I've learned during visitation with my child. How can we document that so that the parent can show that they are improving?
If legal custody is given to DHS, the legislature has required DHS to do two seemingly inconsistent things. One, to develop a reunification plan to provide services to allow the parents to address the jurisdictional bases and reunify the family within a reasonable time. And at the very same time, to develop a concurrent plan, a permanent plan for the child to implement if that doesn't work. And as you see, both of these plans have to allow that within a reasonable time. And within a reasonable time is a term of art. It has to do with this individual child's time window for attachment. And much of what Dr. Buchanan has talked about today, the level of toxic stress and what's been done to alleviate it, how old the child is, the degree of stress really determines to a great degree how much time that child has. The Supreme Court says that this inquiry is child-specific and requires this kind of information. Unfortunately, that's not always done. The information we have is in court often is very general. This child has been in care too long. That's hard to make into any kind of formula that makes sense. If you have a case where the parent's drug treatment counselor says this parent needs from 6 to 12 months in order to take care of this child, without knowing what a reasonable time is for that child, it's hard for a court to know whether to continue the reunification plan or to move to that concurrent plan. One of the initiatives that our juvenile court programs support and participated in that's going statewide beginning last August was one of three initiatives to begin to talk in court about conditions of return. This is a responsibility that the agency has to identify in writing the specific conditions for the child to return home. Most often we're thinking about conditions of return in terms of addressing the jurisdictional bases, like the mother has to successfully complete alcohol treatment. Well, parents can be in counseling and still have a child in the home. And again, the more we think about the stress on a child, first of all, that's already there from the neglect and abuse, and then the additional stress of the separation, these conditions of return should be in the forefront of every hearing. And the training that we do, in fact, the slides that you're seeing today are the slides that are primarily used in the trainings that we do for juvenile court judges and stakeholders. And the Citizens Review Board, about which you'll hear momentarily, and CASA are also thinking in these terms. So that the more specific everybody is about what the conditions for the safe return home of the child are, may not get the juvenile court out of it, but at least the parent knows the concrete things that he or she has to do or stop doing in order to provide a safe home for the child. Dr. Buchanan, do you have some thoughts about that?
In terms of the conditions to return, I got a little bit lost, sorry. I'm just considering the nature of the home. I'm considering what types of things the parent is doing with the child. I'm considering the educational process, whether the child is engaged in school, whether they have the school readiness skills if they're much younger. These are the types of things that I'd be looking at in terms of supporting that family.
And the court also makes orders of visitation. And I think Dr. Buchanan covered the importance of visitation in her comments. One of the things that we're doing again with our training sessions for judges and stakeholders is to say, if the proposal is for, say, 1 hour of supervised visitation, we ask the courts to go through this inquiry. Why supervised? In other words, make the case for that. Let's see what exactly the difficulties are. Why at DHS? Not because DHS is doing anything wrong, but if they're supervised at DHS, right away the frequency and quality of those visits may diminish. Alternatives would be, have you talked with the Boys and Girls Club? Have you talked with church groups in the community? Because one of the things we know from research is that regardless of the basis for jurisdiction, a lot of one of the most important factors in the success in a juvenile dependency case for reunification are the quality and frequency of visitations. And in an era where we have fewer and fewer services available because of budget and other reasons, meaningful visits may be the primary reunification service. Dr. Buchanan?
May I say one more thing? I'd like to comment back on the question about maternal stress and the toxic stress for the parent. And a recent study came out looking at mothers from Coffee Creek Prison, looking at how those mothers who had some kind of contact with their children, whether it was visitation, whether it was letters, whether it was phone calls, those mothers had significantly less stress compared to other mothers. And so having that contact is incredibly important.
If there is jurisdiction and the child is placed out of the home, or even if not, then there are review hearings after that by the court. Also, as you'll hear in a minute, the Citizens Review Board may also review these cases to satisfy the federal requirement that children in foster care for a period of 6 months have their cases reviewed either by a court or administratively. Courts vary across the state as to the frequency of review hearings. There are some courts that have them as often as every 30 days in a case. There are other courts that don't have a review hearing until about 9 months. And that's for a lot of reasons. Much of it has to do with docket and judicial resources within the county. However, the question is, at these hearings, how are the child and parents progressing? Do we still need to have jurisdiction? And is there anything that we should change about the concurrent planning? I think I'm not going to go through these in detail. You have these at the in your materials, but I just wanted to emphasize how important the inquiries are at these hearings, and the important inquiry to me at the review hearing are, if the child is still in substitute care, then what specific things do the parents have to do, and what progress do they have to make in order to safely return the child? And the more specific that is, and the more time limited it is, the more accessible it is to the parent. And all of our standard judgment forms have those inquiries in it. And they direct the judge to go through that process of making the inquiry. Often, as I said earlier, a condition of return or what the parent has to do in the next period are so generally stated, like the mother must successfully complete drug treatment. Well, that means to the parent often that some third party is going to decide when and how that happens. Rather than being very specific, for example, you must attend these sessions. You must have these negative UAs. You must meet your child at the bus stop every day at this time. In other words, to begin to put into practice the parenting expectations that you have anyway. You know, nothing magical is going to happen to change all that once the drug treatment person says, well, the mother has successfully treated drug treatment, because what kind of parenting does that mean the mother can or can't do? And we also, I think, need to focus on the specific parent, not the generic parent, if you will.
If I can just add to that, one of the things that has really improved the practice in juvenile court is exactly what Michael was talking about, and Michael really deserves a lot of credit for taking a leadership role in getting judges to make these findings. I'm certain that there are any number of you sitting before us who have received issues, complaints from constituents that you know, their children are taken away and they have no idea what it is they're supposed to do to get their kids back. One of the things that's a common complaint among parents is that the goalposts are always moved. We were asked to do this and we did this, and now you're saying we have to do something else. So I think the practice is improving. There needs to be, and has been, a greater articulation of what the issues are and what the steps must be to show the progress in order to reunite families or to step away. And I'd like to compliment Michael for the work that he has done in making certain that judges are now aware of that and it's being done more uniformly.
In 1985, the Oregon legislature established the Citizen Review Board. These are volunteers who serve on boards in all counties in the state. They review the cases, progress, and circumstances of children who are in foster care. Over the years, particularly the last few years, their inquiries and findings have been uniform. They often let courts know things that courts didn't know before, like there's a putative father out there we haven't identified. This case is an Indian Child Welfare Act case. There's a relative that's out there waiting to take this child. And those reviews result in recommendations and findings that go to the juvenile courts. This Citizen Review Board process allows courts with crowded dockets to have another review in lieu of a review hearing, and then still to do the court's work. I don't know how familiar you are with the Citizen Review Board process, but you are able to make arrangements to participate in some of those proceedings. And it's not just a group of local people second-guessing. They really do their work. They bring a consistent inquiry to bear on the case. And I think our view is, if the parents and the agency and the courts are seeing and hearing the same inquiry across the state, assuming the inquiry is appropriate, then it's going to make the practice better across the state. One of the problems, I think, and some of the cases that we hear about, the bad cases, if you will, are because the practices are different across the state. And not that sameness is in itself a virtue, but I think we really raise the level of practice when we have these appropriate inquiries, like conditions of return, for example, and like the inquiry I mentioned about supervised visitation. If everybody's hearing that everywhere, then I think that's how you do, if you will, a culture change. That's how you make the culture change. The laws are already there. It's the in large part, it's the implementation that's the challenge. I'll talk about this hearing at last. If you have a child that's been in foster care or the jurisdiction of the court for a year, you must have a permanency hearing. And at that permanency hearing, you decide, if you remember, I talked about the current and the concurrent plan. You determine whether to continue to reunify the family or to go to another plan. And the legislature has determined, and federal law requires it, that adoption be the primary consideration. And only if you've excluded that do you move to other types of plans. I want to make sure I have time for Dr. Buchanan to conclude her remarks. You have the details of the hearings in your packet. I think what I want to let you know is, through the uniform judgment forms, particularly with this hearing, which is the most complex, And you have a sample of the flow chart of this type of hearing in your packet, and also the judgment form. We are moving courts to making, again, standardized, appropriate, legally sufficient inquiries that recognize the things that Dr. Buchanan is talking about. Go ahead.
I'd like to speak a little bit about a few interventions, evidence-based interventions for children and families. I've commented on this briefly, and I'd like to highlight it just a little bit more. There was a study done in 2005 and then again in 2007 related to multidimensional treatment foster care, which is an intervention where the child is placed in out-of-home care, and whether that's because of mental health needs, child welfare needs, or juvenile justice needs. They're placed in a treatment foster care home with a highly skilled and supported foster family. They're provided with individual therapy. They're provided with a youth mentor. And the family is provided with a family therapist who's going to coach them in these five key parenting skills. The first is encouragement. And we've talked about that a little bit here today. And the idea is that the parent notices what the child is doing well and finds some very specific and regular ways to encourage them. And we teach the families to provide encouragement at a ratio of at least 5 to 1. So if I give a correction, I also give 5 encouraging statements or 5 ways to encourage the child. This is a dramatic shift for a lot of our families, especially our families in child welfare who are struggling and often have engaged in very, very harsh parenting, which is potentially more a ratio of, 50 to 1 negative to positive. And so this is a shift for a lot of our kids to be able to experience positive interactions with their parents. The next is appropriate discipline. So small consequences for small behaviors, larger consequences for larger behaviors, but all would be non-harsh. So no hitting, no punching, no slapping, no kicking. All would be privilege removal or small chores perhaps. Small things so that the child is learning, I have a small problem behavior, I have a small consequence. And that's actually a way to teach the parent as well. Supervision is key. Children who are unsupervised tend to hang out with other children who are unsupervised and get into trouble. Particularly true for our children who have poor social skills or have already engaged in delinquent behavior. So we want to make sure that we're supervising them, and we teach the parents how to supervise. So initially, supervision is within line of sight and within earshot. And then as the child gets older, so that would be a 3-year-old, you're on the playground, you want to be able to see them, you want to be able to hear them, you want to be right there with them. As they get older, say you have a teenager, how do you supervise a teenager? They're not necessarily locked in with you all the time, but there are ways to know their friends, to know their friends' parents, to know where they're going and what kinds of things they're doing, to check up on the stories that they're giving us about what they're doing. Separation from delinquent or socially unskilled peer, we've talked about that a little bit. And then the fifth one is educational engagement. It turns out that students who do their homework are less likely to end up in locked settings. They're less likely to end up in psychiatric settings, juvenile courts, etc. And so we want to make sure that our kids who are struggling, are doing homework every day. And so one of the things in multidimensional treatment foster care is that regardless of whether the child has homework from the school, they'd be participating in some sort of academic engaged time for about an hour a day, depending on their developmental level, every single day, including weekends, so that they're getting those study habits in place. Then they're doing this in the foster home. Then they start having visits with their biological families or whoever their aftercare resource is. And their aftercare resource is also practicing these skills. So they're going to go home on visits, and their parent is going to practice the encouragement strategies. They're going to set up a homework routine. They're going to make sure they know their child's friends and peers and that they know where they're going and that they're supervising them. These studies are showing that children who engage in these types of interventions like this are much, much, much less likely to end up in juvenile courts, etc. There's another intervention I'd like to speak to, which is the KEEP intervention, which is for keeping foster parents skilled and supported. And it started off in Oregon, and it is a 16-week intervention that came out of multidimensional treatment foster care. So DHS workers came to us and said, you have this great intervention for children who are removed and are at that high rate, so the ones that Judge Leonard was speaking about who are at high risk and are committing crimes and are in psychiatric settings. What about typical kids who aren't quite there yet or who are younger, who are maybe on that trajectory, but they're not quite there yet? And so the scientists took all the key elements from MTFC, created a 16-week curriculum for foster parents, and they come to a group, they sit together, so there's the support from the group, but then they learn key strategies, these key strategies, and how to specifically apply them with their child. This project started here in Oregon. It was tested in San Diego. And the current incarnation is that the city of New York, Child Welfare, has adopted this intervention. And so there have been, as of last week, 300 caseworkers in New York City in all five boroughs who have been trained to run these foster parent groups. And their idea is that if they can skill up the foster parents, they're less likely to have the kids move from home to home to home. So if you're a really, really challenging child, the likelihood is that I'm going to come to your home, I'm going to have some problem behavior, and then you're going to say, I'm done, I don't want to do this anymore. And then Child Welfare has to move me to another home. And what we know is that each time a child moves from one home to the next, they're more likely to be asked to leave the next home. So if they leave one home, they're more likely to leave the next home, more likely to leave the next. By the time they're in their fifth or sixth home, they might as well not unpack, because the likelihood is they're just going to get moved again. And so the goal of this is that they would be able to stay in one home, and we'd have foster parents who would have the skill to be able to support them. The other piece of this project is the aftercare family, the biological family. And so they're getting a very similar intervention where they're learning these key strategies with the idea that once the child goes home, they're going to stay there and they're going to be able to be supported in their home. And they're going to be able to have their brain development moving forward, their academic development moving forward, and progress that way.
I might just offer to interject that we have Rohana here today, fresh off the plane from having been in New York last week training people on these programs. But more importantly, that New York is learning from Oregon, and I think we have some resources in the state of Oregon, particularly with the Oregon Social Learning Center and other programs as well, that we can take full advantage of and to help the practices that we have here. And it's not something that is a horribly costly program. It's information and training on how to be a better foster parent, how to be a better parent. And so we're lucky to have her here today, and we thank her for actually taking time out of her day after she just got back from New York City.
One of the practical and important consequences of a program like Dr. Buchanan just described, let's take two children. They come into court with the same circumstances. One goes into the five or six foster homes. The other stays in that stable foster home. The reasonable time for one of those children is not the same as the reasonable time for the other. In other words, the child who's in the stable home is more likely to have less stress, is more likely to be able to be in a safe place long enough for the parents to fix whatever they need to address. The other child, the clock is running. And again, with the paucity of services in some counties, just a simple investment in, I'm not talking about money so much as just reallocated resources that are currently available into a focused foster program so that you don't have the child moving, that has a positive effect for the parents themselves, because then the parent has the opportunity to do the work to correct the situation that keeps the child out of the home. It's an investment for not just the child but for the parents.
One of the other interventions I wanted to describe briefly is very appropriate for those visitation. So whether that happens in the office or whether that happens in the home or whether that happens in the community, oftentimes parents don't know what to do during their visitation with their child. They aren't given sort of a roadmap. So they have their kid, they have a two-way mirror and there's somebody watching them, they have some toys, and they don't know what to do with their child. They don't have the skills. The child has been removed for abuse and neglect, potentially because the parent doesn't know how to interact with their child. And one of the interventions that you can do is you can give the parent these very, very specific activities. Let's say it's a two-year-old. A two-year-old has been removed for neglect. And when you see the parent interacting with the child, they don't make eye contact. They don't coo and babble back and forth at each other. They don't have child talk. They don't play. And these are the specific things that we can teach parents to do. So on this visit, what you're going to do is you're going to notice what your child is interested in, and you're going to play with them and do those things. It's very, very simple. And it's the types of things that you see parents doing all the time.
your child points to something and you point to that and you say, oh, that's a ball, or oh, that's the TV, or oh, that's your sister, and you would go through and you would name sort of the world around you, right? And we see this all the time. It doesn't stand out so dramatically until it's absent. And so when you have a child who has not ever had this back and forth, and the folks at Harvard, the videos I was showing you earlier, they call this serve and return. And the idea is that the child serves by initiating contact. So they say, ah, what's this? Or, and they look at something. And then the return is the parent's response to that. And it goes back and forth. Sometimes it goes back and forth a little bit longer than others, right? Because some kids have a little bit more attention span. The other piece of this is that the parent is focused on what is the child interested in. So yes, we do lead our children through the day often, but at the same time, we want to make sure that we're noticing what they're interested in and furthering their development by encouraging their exploration of the world.
Why don't you touch on a couple of the other interventions as well? I think it's fascinating, the kids program and
the kids program is kids in transition to school, and it's a preschool intervention. And they're doing some really very cool things right now where they're recruiting in the promise neighborhoods in Lane County, and particularly in Eugene and Springfield, and going and finding children who are going to go into preschool. And it's tricky to find kids who are going into preschool because they're not already on the rolls, they're not already on the register. So they go door to door to door to find young children who are getting ready for preschool in these sort of high-risk neighborhoods. And then they run these, there's a parenting component and a school readiness play group that they run for these little guys. And it's incredible that they can get these young guys who might not have had a lot of academic engagement at home. So these might be families where there aren't a lot of books, there's not a lot of literacy, there's not a lot of encouragement for education, and they teach the parents to do these things, and they also get the children ready. So they teach them how to raise their hand, they teach them how to sit still for a little while, they teach them how to do circle time, so that when they start preschool, they sort of have an advantage that they would not otherwise have had. And then they're following these students to see how those effects show up.
Senator Dingfelter?
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Two things. One is, it has to do with what you just talked about, because what I'm hearing is, by the time that a case comes to the court, oftentimes, I don't want to say it's too late because you have a lot of innovative practices that you're trying to implement, but obviously, I mean, we're already behind the eight ball in, mm-hmm. in making a difference in these children's lives. So are you looking at Head Start, for example, as a place where you can be proactive with parents, because obviously these are kids, this is preschool, you know, you're, mm-hmm. you've got ready-made audience there, and I think about, you know, I work very closely with the Head Starts in my district, and I'm curious how much proactive, and I know it's not the courts, mm-hmm. I mean, this is where the seamless, you know, the continuum that you talked about is so important when we're looking at early childhood. So that's number one, and then the second question I had is about cultural sensitivity mm-hmm. for these trainings, because obviously you've talked a lot about Native American children, but certainly Asian, I have a very large Asian American population, Latino, different cultural sensitivities as you're looking at these interventions.
So to your first question about Head Start, the two scientists who are running the KITS program, they do collaborate with Head Start.
Yes.
And they do some trainings with them and some support for them, absolutely, to help that proactive approach. And then in terms of cultural sensitivity, there's sort of a few things there. One is that the studies consistently show that these types of parenting practices are effective across cultures. And in particular, the population that I've worked with more is the Latino population in Oregon and San Diego, and then also in New York. And so adapting it to work, adapting the language, the materials, those types of things to make it fit. I can't speak directly to Native American populations because I don't work with that population, but I can see that there are ways to make this fit into various cultures. Making sure that you involve the stakeholders in that process definitely helps you get a lot farther.
And just a quick follow-up, if I may, on that, because I've worked work a lot with especially Native American population in my district, and I have, the city of Portland has more Native Americans, I think, than any part of the state, just because we're an urban population, and so we have a lot of Native American families, and I've heard concerns, and I know there's been bills about how DHS and the foster care system deals with specifically with Native American children and not being sensitive to particular needs of that culture. And so that's something I think would be worth looking into or having a little more analysis done. And I think the same as, you know, people come over from, for instance, families where they've been in displacement camps. Mm-hmm. And obviously they've gone through a lot of stress in their native countries, and then they're coming here and dealing with additional stress and, you know, how that affects the children as they're transitioning to a new culture.
Absolutely.
So I have a couple of follow-ups from what Senator Dinkfelder, you know, the Head Start program seems like a great program to be working with. But as we know in Lane County, I know it just changed its name from birth to three, be a program that starts even earlier. And I know that that program, is that actually being fostered out in other parts of the state, in the sense of it seems to me that that's where you could actually get higher, quicker dividends than waiting until the child is just about going into school?
If I may, so birth to three, they've changed it to parenting now.
Parenting
now. And I can't keep up with the name changes.
I can't either.
Yeah.
And they are part of, I'm going to try and remember the name. They're part of a parenting consortium in the state of Oregon. And so not only are they starting literally at birth, and so they're finding parents who are pregnant, and as soon as the child is born, they're trying to work with them for these types of parenting skills right off the bat in these parenting groups. And they're very, this is very cool work. But they changed it from birth to three to parenting now because they actually want to extend it up to older years.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, briefly. I was on the Governor's Task Force on Disproportionality and Inequity in the Foster Care System, and some of the statistics that they revealed there were very most of the judges and caseworkers are Caucasian white people. Apparently most of the caseworkers in Oregon are white women, or at least a large percentage of them. And it was very clear that children of Native American and African American homes were more likely to be removed from a home, even though there's no, according to these statistics that they gave us, there's no real proof that a child's more likely to be abused in an African American or Native American home. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side of that, because of our ingrained subconscious prejudice, which we probably all have as a defense mechanism, instinct to be afraid of things that may be different, white children were more likely to be left in a less than safe environment because they were white. Have you run across any of that?
I can't speak directly to that in my experience, no. Huh. But I've heard similar types of things, but I have not read the reports myself.
Well, wouldn't that go basically to the training and the cultural sensitivity? I mean, I think what I hear Representative Shoffer talking about is that if you don't have individuals that are working for the agencies, having this understanding, they may be more perceived to having their cultural bias, whatever that is, interfere, impact that relationship.
Absolutely. Senator Brzezinski, just a somewhat of a follow-up on that, if I could. An example of what I'm going to say is the conditions of return. That's a DHS policy and practice. It's in their rules. And I didn't mean to suggest that this was something the court came up with. But what happens is so often there's a great policy at the central office level that's not implemented consistently across the state. And so what we're trying to do with that initiative, and it really goes to this issue you're talking about here too, is to really support the good programs and policy that DHS has in the community, because there really is somewhat of a disconnect, as you can imagine, between translating great central office policy into the different communities in the state. And that's one of the benefits of the uniformity that I've talked about. And another example is the sensitivity to culture and ethnic background. The policies at the state level, and it's all across the board, look great, but it's the implementation that matters. It's really, and that's why we think this using data that we know, what we know to implement in the court, and to be consistent across the state with that, really is the best way to raise the level of practice across the board.
Before we continue, yeah, are we going to do more on PowerPoint?
We're done.
Okay, can we go ahead and bring the lights up, please?
Kip? It's we're about 2 minutes from our allotted time. So I thought maybe I'd summarize so you can.
Yeah, we can go another 4 or 5 minutes. Okay. And some members are going to leave, but we need to be.
What we really want to try to do with the judiciary and with legislators and with the executive branch is challenge the focus and the assumption that many of us have had that if we just work with parents and deal with the issues that they present, that everything's going to be okay in families. That's just part of what it is that we need to do in cases involving abuse and neglect and cases involving delinquency. We need to deal with the entire family. We need to be aware of the effects of abuse and neglect and other stresses on children, and we need to be able to work with them so that when we are in a position to reunite a family, we're reuniting parents who are healthier and children who are healthier. And the research that Dr. Buchanan and her colleagues are doing is enlightening, and we need to take advantage of that. And also the interventions that have been described are some of the interventions that are possible. I think I made a comment one time in one of our work group sessions that we probably do about 15% of what we know works, and much of what we know works we're not talking necessarily about expensive programs. We're just talking about changing focus and perhaps a reallocation of the resources that are already out there. I think we're lucky in this state. We've highlighted the Oregon Social Learning Center and Dr. Buchanan and her colleagues. There are any number of other great resources that we have, and we need to use those. Somehow we tend to think, and I really am using myself as the example, but since I did this work for a dozen years, there's this thought that, gee, I know how to parent, I'm a parent, so I should be able to apply what I know and do as a parent to the cases that come before me or the people that we're dealing with. And there's much more to it than that. I mean, that's part of it. I think that also we need, and I speak of I, make sure we don't do some of the things that I did as a parent. But it's there, and we can do a better job. We can educate ourselves, and we would like to offer the assistance of myself, Mr. Livingston, Dr. Buchanan, other people, other resources. Judge Brewer is a tremendous advocate for these efforts. So as the session, you begin the session and these issues come up, please feel free to get a hold of us. I know that Representative Krieger, you and Judge Brewer are in contact a lot on a lot of these issues. If we can marshal some resources, bring some information before you, bring some people before you, please ask. It's not that suppose that we have all the answers, but at least we can inform the discussion a bit. We thank you very much for your time, and if you do want to ask some additional questions, we're here to answer them. Otherwise, I think we can help you get back on schedule.
All right, I have one other question. I want to follow up with what Senator Wissett brought up about an allegation being founded or unfounded. Can you just walk us through, because I want to know whether or not if a child is brought before the court, is the founding determined at the time they're before the court, or is that an internal process that's done, first of all?
It's an internal DHS process. It's the example that I gave of my friend who was trying to get his 2-year-old into the car. DHS had a referral. They investigated it and determined that it was unfounded. Had DHS investigated it and determined in their assessment of that information that there was abuse going on, then it would be coded as a founded referral. So it's a DHS process. But it's really DHS, in some ways it's DHS record keeping. If they receive a referral, of course they have to create and maintain a history of that. And so it is listed as unfounded, but it still is part of DHS records. And I think we can imagine if it's us and we didn't do anything, we don't even want that. But on the other hand, if there is perhaps a little bit of smoke there. You want to make sure that the history exists. So you're in a tough spot. But it's a DHS process. It's not a judicial finding.
Right. So basically, and this is more for the record, if it's founded and then it comes to before the court and the court, for whatever reason, determines the child is okay to stay with the child, with existing parents, and there is no removal, etc., and all this, there's still going to be on the record, I guess, in DHS that when they initially took this in, they had that finding, and that's why it went forward into the court proceeding.
Yes, there can be a, the DHS can then file a petition in juvenile court, and there the responses, the findings in juvenile court, can there can be a variety of events there. As Mr. Livingston was telling us, that there can be situations when there is jurisdiction. The court does find that the allegations have been proved, but leaves the children in the home and provide services. So the fact that there is jurisdiction and the allegation has been proved doesn't necessarily mean that there is going to be foster care. The original hearing is the shelter hearing, and that starts the process. It is a rough equivalent to an arraignment in a criminal case. The allegation may not be proved and the court would not take jurisdiction. Of course, there would be a record of that. There's a record of everything that happens before the court. I think that what the juvenile system does not have, which, and I throw this out only kind of by way of analogy, not by suggestion, in the criminal world, for example, there are expungements, there's sealing of records, there are things like that. They're not the equivalent sort of processes in the dependency cases. Michael, did you want to add anything to that?
No, just that it is an internal DHS process, but at the shelter hearing, there is, in order for the court to order shelter care, the court has to find that there's probable cause for the petition, that the child's within the court's jurisdiction. So you could have a case where at the shelter hearing, the court denies the request for shelter care. That could be, and probably should be, in the order, a finding that there's not probable cause on the petition. And now, what DHS standard is aside from that, I'm not familiar with, but it is an internal process, and I think the process for grieving that finding of founded abuse is an internal administrative law process.
To amplify a little bit, just to make sure that, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but the case I referred to as the case that ended up the murder of the child, there were reports to DHS which were unfounded, which DHS coded as unfounded. Because nobody came forward, nobody was willing to substantiate the information that DHS had. It's very inexact in some cases.
Representative Krieger.
Just real quick, you know, Senator Cruz and I had a case recently where district attorney's office investigated accusations, police did the same, and the psychiatrists all say, hey, it never happened, but yet the state comes back and says it's founded and the people lose their license. Mm-hmm. And it was absolute unbelievable. I mean, talk about a lack of justice.
But it would seem, though, that there should be some type of administrative procedure to challenge that. In the sense of,
you would have to do it within 30 days on an appeal, and they were never advised of that.
Okay.
Chair?
I think...
Real quick, I got Senator Wissett, then.
I think the only appeal of administrative decision is through the appellate court, and it's my understanding, and that proceeding is limited by the what's been allowed into the record in the administrative procedure.
That's right.
So it's really, really difficult to turn over administrative
action. But prior to going to the court, there's an internal appeal part to reach the point of where there's a final order that's then appealable to the court.
I think there's another piece of information that is necessary, and that is that the parent may not be aware of what has happened. It's not as though there has been some sort of notification given that DHS is considering this issue and is going to either make a determine that it's founded or unfounded. It happens. A parent may not even be aware that DHS has been contacted. So it's a little fuzzier than that.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Shelfer.
And the reason this person called me is because I was one of the sponsors of one of those bills we had relating to false accusations that were proven false. And I called the department up and to make sure this person was not even on their list. Apparently they'd expunged whatever record there were. They were totally exonerated. Their child was healthy and safe and in a different place, at home with mom and dad, but it was related to the school they were in. And the department told me that law has, I don't think, ever been implemented in any case. And I don't know how many years ago that was, but, and this father, I think he wanted some vengeance, and I can appreciate him wanting some vengeance, but I said the best vengeance is living well. You know, you've had enough stress already, your little baby's safe and happy. I suggest you just forget about it and just be grateful you did. You know, one of those bad things where somebody, this person was falsely accusing them of doing something, and this person has a long history too. It's on the internet. But anyway, that law, though, has never, to my knowledge, never been thoroughly implemented in a case. So I don't know.
Thanks. Well, with this, I want to thank you all for being here. This is a very informative panel and information. And thanks, Doctor, for you being here, knowing that you've got a very tight schedule. I know the judge will be retired. We can get him up here whenever we need to.
I got to tell you, getting up early, putting a tie on, just about brought back bad memories.
I understand.
And I love being here with you guys. It's all worthwhile now. But I really do want to, and because I know that we have real friends of these issues here, I can't speak highly enough of the work that Dr. Buchanan, Dr. Fisher, I know who some of you have spent some time with, and others do. And they're just a wealth of information. And apart from the implementing programs, they just, I think, can help inform these discussions in a way that lawyers and judges really have a hard time and don't have the expertise to do. So please call on them, unless she's in New York training people to apply for grants. And I know that she'd come at the drop of a hat.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And Michael, thank you for your time, too.
With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the Interim Judiciary Committee for our legislative days of December 10th.